A Simple Thing, written by Iridan, read by Marianas. Chapter 47, Atin. Din stood alone in the wreckage of Boba's throne room, struggling to understand what had happened. He knew in his head what had happened, of course. He'd known it as soon as he realized, crouching in front of the boy in the Jedi Academy's mess hall, who Gari was. Din had known how Gorga had been getting his information, how he'd been staging his attacks. Din had known what had happened the moment he'd calmed Boba, then Fennec, then Nura, and Kasik, and Cobb, and the palace itself, trying to reach someone, anyone, that Din could warn, and had gotten only silence back. But Din's heart was still confused, bewildered, betrayed. "Gita's my friend," Din thought distantly, staring at Boba's throne. A dark streak of sooty carbon was burned into the back of the wood. She couldn't have wanted for this to happen. Boba's throne was, aside from the burn, relatively untouched. It was his new throne, the one that Nura had commissioned to replace the throne that Paz had melted in a fit of bad temper. It had just been installed a few weeks ago. The rest of the room was in ruins. Chairs and tables were broken, overturned, the floor scattered with shattered clay cups and broken spatchka bottles, fragments of wood, discarded plates. Starfighter fire had torn an enormous hole in the roof, littering the floor with sand and dust and chunks of stone. The walls were scored in 100 places, dented, gray with soot. She couldn't have wanted this. Nura's tapestry had been torn in two. Half of it fluttered sadly in the wind, which stirred sand and motes of dust up around Din's boots, and the other half lay burned and torn on the floor. Din could barely make himself look at it. He couldn't make himself look at the bodies, either. The throne room was just as full of them as it was of fragments of wood and great chunks of stone. But Din couldn't look at them, not yet. He didn't want to see anyone that he knew. Din knew that Geeta hadn't wanted anyone to get hurt. He remembered how upset she'd been after the first raid when Zero had been killed by Gorga's mercs. She'd been devastated, pale, frightened. "I didn't think Zero would get hurt," she had said. Din closed his eyes against the memory. "She found me in the city that day," he thought. "In Mos Eisley, when I went hunting for Hutt sympathizers and found Geeta and Ruli instead." Had she been sending information to Gorga's network even then? Had she been looking for Din to keep tabs on him, to report on his movements? "I told her that I was going to be off-planet," Din thought. The horror was duller now than it had been when Din had first realized that Geeta was one of Gorga's spies. He'd had a very long, very tense flight in hyperspace to think about all of the information that he'd given away because Din had trusted Geeta. Because he'd looked at her and seen someone who had needed Din's protection. He had offered up the palace on an erudite platter. He'd told her that he wouldn't even be on the planet to protect it. Din had told Geeta that he'd be gone for several days. And she'd told Gorga, who had clearly taken advantage of Din's absence. The palace was a wreck. Din had been able to see the smoke for miles as he dropped out of the black and cut down through Tatooine's atmosphere so fast the Kyrkfly's heat shields had started to sputter and fail underneath the strain. He'd been able to see the smoke from the stratosphere. Underneath the horror, a curl of rage flickered behind Din's ribs. Din had trusted Geeta, and she'd taken that trust and sold it to Gorga the Hutt instead. But then Din thought of Gari, small and fragile, sitting in the mess hall with his shoulders tucked up around his ears, watching everyone warily, afraid that his rescuers were his new masters now, afraid that his life hadn't changed at all. Gari was just a child. Gita was a child, really. She'd gotten tangled up in Boba's outfit because she'd been kidnapped. Din remembered that now. Her mother, Imiri, had come to Boba for help because Gita had been stolen away. Imiri hadn't had anyone else to turn to. She'd wanted her daughter back. We thought that it was random, Din thought. That it was ordinary. Twi'lek dancing girls get kidnapped all the time. The Sarlanes are full of them. A pretty girl like Gita going missing, what's unusual about that on Tatooine? But it had been a trick. Bait. Din could see that now. Gita had been abducted, but she'd been stolen so that Boba could send someone to rescue her, so that Boba would accept Gita into the outfit without too much trouble, without asking too many questions. So that Boba and Fennec and Din would see nothing more than a frightened girl and let her in underneath their armor, past their defenses. And we, Din thought, refusing to spare himself any blame. We bought it. Gorga's people, Joss's gang, had tied Gita out like a Tusken hunter staked an Eopi down in the sands to lure a crate dragon from its cave, and all of them had taken the bait. Gita had been brought into the fold. She'd been one of them. Din had protected her, saved her life, even. And she, what, Din thought, sold us all to Gorga? Din remembered the smoke in the air the night he and Gita had been attacked on the road to Mos Eisley. He remembered the garrote around his neck in the alleys of the Gleaning, the weak way behind him trying to strangle Din to death. Gita had been there that day, too. Eyes still screwed shut, Din couldn't help but see everything that he'd missed before. The signs had been there. Gita's wariness, her skittishness, how unhappy she'd been, how closed off. She had tried not to get close to them, to any of them, but they must have started threatening her, Din realized. She told Nora that she was being followed home. That was Joss's crew intimidating her, making her afraid, driving her towards us. She told me that someone was watching her, that she was scared. Gita had been Gorga's spy, but Din, Nora, Fennec, Kasik, Zero, all of them had jumped in to help Gita feet first, eyes open. Only after Din had started to take Gita home after her shifts at the bar had she opened up to him, gotten closer. She knew that Ushib was more than Boba's cook, too, Din realized. Gita had worked the bar, and the bar staff and the kitchen staff worked closely together. Ushib had been one of the first of Boba's outfit to go missing. She'd been abducted weeks ago. Boba and Din had found her together the night they had brought Paz and the Verdike back from Arcanus. Gita had closed down the bar almost every night since then. She'd been there when Boba had cleared out his business partners and petitioners, the gamblers and the band and the palace's ordinary guests, and took dinner with his closest allies. She'd learned their movements, their patterns. And she knew that I was close to Boba, too. She'd probably seen Din and Boba come down from Boba's tower together half a dozen times. She'd seen Din keep watch over Boba by the stairs. Din screwed his eyes shut so tightly that his jaw ached. Smoke stung his eyes and burned his nose, filled it with a stink of scorched carbon and blood, of spilled spatchka, of dust and stone. He couldn't stop seeing Gari's face, wide-eyed but guarded, afraid. What would I have done, Din wondered, if someone had taken Paz when I was a kid, and then offered me a way to get Paz back, to keep him safe? If they'd told me that they would hurt my brother unless I helped them. Din wondered who else had traded information to Gorga. Din knew it couldn't just be Gita alone. She'd been brought close to Boba's inner circle, but she hadn't known all of it, hadn't known everything about the outfit and how it was run, and she hadn't been in the palace every day. Dairy? Din wondered, thinking of the Wookiee mother who'd asked for Boba's help in finding her missing son, Air Shur. The brothers, Kansek and Iju? What about Gita's friends? Does Theron have anyone he lost down the Sarlanes? Does Tava? And Cobb? Who in Mos Pelgo's lost someone to Joss's crew? Where's the leak in his network? Cobb hadn't answered his comm either. Din already knew what had happened to Mos Pelgo. The same thing that had happened here. but he hadn't seen the town yet. He knew that it probably hadn't fared any better than the palace. That it had probably fared worse. Muspelga didn't have the palace's walls to protect it. Boba's ranks had swelled with new recruits over the last few months. As Boba had fought off the first few Hutt attacks, as he'd settled in and grown his little kingdom, as he'd started to make his business thrive again, he'd signed on dozens and dozens of new employees. People had started to feel safe, had started to feel like Boba's outfit was a decent one to band up with. They'd wanted Boba's credits, his protection. How many of them had joined up just to get information for the Hutts? Fennec vetted everyone that she could, Din reminded himself. She went through our ranks pretty thoroughly. But she was looking for willing spies. For those who'd give Gorga information because they wanted to, because they hoped to get something out of it. Clink, power, influence. She wasn't looking for anyone who was forced to spy. Hard in his throat, Din made himself open his eyes. What Geeta had done, what Fennec and Din and Boba had missed, it didn't matter, not now. It was done. Finished. Gorga's mercenaries had come to the palace in force, and Din had come too late to stop them. He'd calmed Boba and Fennec from the temple on Yavin 4 as soon as Din had realized the implications of what Gari had told him, as soon as Din had fit the pieces together. He'd tried to raise them first on the comlink he'd borrowed from Voss, finger shaking. Din's calm was still broken, cracked first by Boba in the desert and then half-drowned in the lake on Cronest, and then again from the Kyrick Fly when his borrowed calm had returned only silence. Neither of them had answered. Din had known then that he was too late, that Gorga's forces had already attacked. Silence from Boba, Din could explain away silence from Boba, he didn't know how long the trip from Cronest to Tatooine took. Din had half-hoped that Boba's calm had been quiet because Boba had still been in hyperspace, still traveling, still safe. But Fennec always answered her calm, and if she didn't, she was good about getting back to Din as soon as she had a spare second. With Boba away from Tatooine, she would have kept her calm on her. She would have answered it immediately if she could have. But she hadn't answered, and neither had anyone else that Din had tried vision narrowing before he'd given up and thrown himself headfirst into hyperspace aimed at Tatooine. Gorga would have... He would have wanted Boba to be here, Din thought, staring at the carbon burn scored across the back of Boba's throne. He would have wanted to make sure that his mercs got Boba, too. At the very least, Gorga would have wanted to lure Boba into an ambush, and the fact that Boba hadn't calmed Din back told Din that Gorga's mercs had succeeded. Anger, cold as the water on Cronest, sloshed inside of Din's chest. This is Gorga's fault, Din reminded himself. This is the Hutt cartel's fault. They were happy enough to leave Tatooine to rot when someone incompetent was in charge and paying them protection credits. But when Boba took over and turned the outfit around, they suddenly decided that they cared, that they wanted Tatooine back. That was Din's real enemy, the Hutt cartel and their greed. Geeta, she betrayed us, Din thought, but she was caught in a trap too. Geeta had lost her brother, both of her brothers, actually, and her sisters too. Her entire family had been chewed up by the great hungry maw of the Sorrowlanes, and it was the Hutts who'd grown fat and rich off of that sorrow, feeding on the pain and misery of others like a Minok leeched power from a ship. They're slavers, Din thought. They've always been slavers. Jabba had built his empire on the backs of others. The Hutts are my enemy. Din focused on that certainty. He sharpened his anger against it like a Verd knife, honing it to a killing edge. Din had come too late to stop Gorga from enacting his plan, too late to save the palace. But if Gorga's mercs had killed Boba, had killed Fennec, had killed any of Boba's people, Din hadn't come too late to get revenge. The urge to tear out of the palace through the gash in the roof and make straight for Nar Shadda, blasters blazing, darksaber lit in his fist, nearly overwhelmed Din for a minute. He wasn't an angry person by nature, he didn't think, but... The palace, the people in it. They're my people, my tribe. They were the only tribe that Din had left. If they'd been killed, Din was honor-bound, blood-bound, bound by his armor and his name and the right to call himself a warrior, to see vengeance paid. I am Mandalorian. Mandalorians, they took care of their tribes, their clans, and when they failed, they took vengeance. Din had walked away from the squabbling on Cronest, from the feuding, from Clan Ordo getting revenge on Clan Awad and Clan Kryz on Clan Fett, from the Children of the Watch and the True Mandalorians and the rest of the political tangle of competing families and interests and histories that Din knew he had no hope of understanding and no desire to try. Gorga the Hutt is not Mandalorian. Gorga was an Arue, an enemy. Killing Gorga would be right. Not yet, though. Din cautioned himself, wrapping a hand around his rage and clutching it tight. If he needed to get vengeance, he'd get it. Din would die getting it if he had to. But I don't see Boba here. Holding down his rage on the desire to make for Nar Shadda and make Gorga afraid, Din tried to let Aboroy's cool focus steal over him instead. He needed to think. The throne room was full of bodies, but none of them were dressed in Boba's black robes, his green armor. None of them were wearing Nora's billowing comfortable pants or Fennec's black and orange coat. They're not here. I need to find them. Vengeance is important, but if they're alive... If Boba's people were alive, then Din needed to protect them. That was more important than any vengeance. He knew that. He believed that, usually. That knowledge was just harder to reach, standing here in the ruins of Boba's home. My home. Din took a steadying breath. Gorga is a Hutt, Din thought, trying to sink into the familiar thought patterns of a bounty hunter. It shouldn't have been hard. Din had been a hunter for most of his life. He knew how to think like one. He was one. What are Hutts before they're anything else? He asked himself. The answer came in fits and starts, half smothered by Din's fury, but it did come. They're business beings. The Hutts had run a quarter of the galaxy for hundreds of years. They'd done it through cruelty and bribery, through flattery, through war. But mostly they'd done it by cutting good deals. They were stingy with their credits. They made safe bets. Killing everyone in the palace would have been a safe bet if Gorga's goal had been to just topple a rival, but there weren't enough bodies around for that. Fennec said... She said that her spies had told her that Gorga was strapped for credits, Din thought. He had all of the pieces. He'd had them for weeks. He just needed to fit them together. Valerian told me the same thing. Din had spoken to her in Mosentha. Lady Valerian had outlasted the Hutts for years. She knew them well. Gorga was having trouble putting the clink together to raise a proper army. He was paying for the cheapest mercs he could find. But cheap mercs had been turned back by Boba's outfit handily enough. Gorga's first raid on the palace had failed. So he paid for better mercs then, or he paid for more. Even Boba would get overrun if Gorga threw enough bodies at him. And if the Hutt is already strapped for credits, I bet Gorga will be looking for any way to make some clink back that he can find. Tatooine was situated along the Sour Lanes. Killing one's enemies was economical in Din's opinion, but then he wasn't a Hutt and didn't have a Hutt's greed. Some of us, we'd fetch a good price, he thought grimly. Mandalorians, after all, were prized in the fighting pits. Wookiees, too. Tuskens were ferocious fighters. Boba's guards all had combat training. There'd be other buyers, too, not just the fighting pits. Fennec was frighteningly good at her job. Nora was clever and beautiful. Geeta was a dancer. The people of Mos Pelgo were already miners and farmers. The New Republic had tried to crack down on the spice mines of Kessel, on the silicax mines of Tatooine, the fighting pits of Nar Shadda, but the Outer Rim was wild. The Sour Lanes still ran throughout much of the galaxy, still turned a good profit. Gorga's greedy, and he's proud, too. All of the Hutts are proud, Din thought. Some more than others. Jabba would punish any slight, real or imagined, with immediate and often brutal death. How would Gorga deal with a slight? Selling all of Boba's people off into slavery would be a lesson, Din supposed, a warning to other potential rivals, and a way to make some credits besides. But Boba. Gorga wouldn't sell Boba. Boba had done more than slight Gorga. Boba had resisted him. He'd shrugged off the Hutt's attempts to take back Jabba's empire on Tatooine. He'd stood up to them, and for a while, Boba had won. That was a grave insult. An affront. Boba's defiance, his continued success, had made Gorga look weak. Boba's continued existence must have offended Gorga's very pride. So, what do the Hutts do when their pride has been offended? Din thought. The answer to that question came faster. The bounty hunter, clinical and calculating, used to living in this part of the galaxy and neatly compartmentalizing its casual cruelties, its easy brutality. And the answer left Din very cold. He shivered, despite the sunlight streaming into the palace from the hole in the roof, despite the lingering heat of blaster fire, of heavy ordnance, of a few hundred bodies fighting desperately in a small space. Hutts make spectacles of their enemies. Cobb Vanth had been the first person to tell Din how Jabba had died. About the pit of Carcoon, about Jabba hauling his entire court out into the middle of nowhere just to put on a show, to make a point. Would he want to do something like that? Din wondered. Would he want to toss Boba to a rancor or tie him to a stake to go mad under the sun, soak him in fresh blood, and leave him tied out for a crate dragon's meal? Then he shook his head. He didn't even know if Gorga was on planet. Din couldn't get too far ahead of himself. Planning for what might happen wouldn't do Din any good. What he needed was to look around the throne room, to find evidence, to figure out exactly what had happened and where the mercs had gone. Din took another deep breath, smoke stinging the back of his throat, and forced himself to set everything else, his grief, his fear, his bewildered hurt, and his cold, deep anger aside. Din needed to be the hunter now. Nothing else mattered. He looked around the throne room again, and his focus sharpened. Gorga's mercenaries had caught the throne room and its occupants by surprise. It wasn't the best place to fend off a siege from. If Boba had known that Gorga's army was coming, he would have retreated deeper into the palace, somewhere with a choke point, somewhere where Boba and his people controlled all of the variables. But the fight had been here. They weren't ready. Din went over to the nearest body and nudged it with his boot, turning it over to get a good look at it. It wasn't anyone that Din knew. The body belonged to a Deveronian, red-skinned with two horns that curled up over his forehead. He'd caught a blaster bolt to the chest, a dark hole seared into the gap between two plates of Katarn-class body armor. The Deveronian's eyes were still open. A merc, Din thought. He didn't know all of Boba's guards by name, but he knew their faces. This Deveronian wasn't one of Boba's. The body was stiff underneath Din's boot. It had been at least a handful of hours since the attack then, but not a full day. It couldn't have been a full day, Din thought. Boba and I, we were on Kronost a day ago. Gorga wouldn't have been able to catch Boba in an ambush if Boba had dropped out of hyperspace after the attack on the palace. Din had been able to see the smoke, the debris, from the Karking stratosphere. Gorga's mercs had hit the palace hard, but the palace had hit back. The sands for miles around the palace, almost all the way to Mos Eisley, which Din had roared over with his ship still trailing flames from his entry into the atmosphere, had been scattered with bits of destroyed hunter-killers and starfighters. The palace had still been smoking when Din had landed out front. Boba would have seen the wreckage, too. He would have gone to ground. He would have been angry, Din knew, but Boba wasn't stupid. He wouldn't have flown himself headfirst into a trap. And he would have come to me for help, Din thought. But he didn't, so. So, Gorga's mercs had waited until Boba was back in the palace, until they'd known that Boba was back in the palace. And then, once they'd known, they attacked. It had taken Din a handful of hours to get between Kronost and Yavin 4. The flight between Yavin 4 and Tatooine took almost 8 hours, even at light speed. Din did the math in his head, triangulating. It had probably taken Boba 8 or 9 hours, maybe 10, to get between Kronost and Tatooine. So the Mercs attacked 4 or 5 hours ago, 6 at the most, Din decided. Long enough for the fires to burn out, though white smoke still curled through the air from the gash in the throne room's roof. Long enough for the bodies left behind to stiffen. I can work with 6 hours. 6 hours wasn't that much of a head start, all things considered. Not even in the desert, when wind and sand could shift and cover up any tracks before a full day had passed. But the Mercs had gone somewhere. Din knew that the Mercs hadn't gone through Mos Eisley. Joss's crew aside, Boba had controlled most of the city. The people there would have seen the fighting, the ships swarming the palace, the smoke, and gone to ground. The spaceports would have shut down. He's got a pretty good handle on Mos Espa, too, and Valerian runs Mos Entha, Din thought. But the Mercs aren't here, which means they went somewhere else. They could have left Tatooine on their own ship, of course, but for them to take everyone with them, they would need a pretty large ship, and Din hadn't seen the signs of one around the palace. If they'd taken Boba, taken Fennec, off-planet, 6 hours could get the Mercs parsecs and parsecs away, but... But the idea of them leaving the planet, that doesn't sit right, Din thought. It doesn't feel right. Din's instincts had served him pretty well. He leaned on them now. No, he thought slowly. I don't think that Gorga's Mercs took our people off planet, not yet. Gorga, he'll want to make a point. He'll want to make an example of us, so... What? Din thought. The Mercs went somewhere else? Does Gorga have another palace on planet? Din had never heard of one, but he'd hardly been everywhere on Tatooine. The desert was vast and sprawling. If Gorga's people were still on Tatooine, Din would need to find them quickly. Tatooine was enormous, and it was full of places to hide. I can find them, Din told himself. I need to work quickly. He sank back into his hunter's focus, half-lidding his eyes while he thought. There was no time to bury the dead, even though Din wanted to. No time to call for help, either. Din was sure that the Mandalorian summit was still going strong, its warriors hacking each other to pieces out on the ice. And the Jedi knew that there was trouble here on Tatooine anyway. Voss had promised to come when he could. He'd promised to rally the Jedi, though the knights and masters who'd rescued the children with Voss were all tired and battle-worn, many of them injured. The Mandalorians wouldn't come to Din's aid even if he calmed and asked them to, and he didn't have half a day to wait for them, even if they did. Din had walked away from them, after all. Bo-Katan had asked Din to stay, and he hadn't. He'd left. He pushed that grief aside, too. There was work to do. Din moved on from the Deveronian's body, trying to piece together what had happened. It was harder to do without his helmet than Din would have thought. He hadn't realized, really, just how much he'd relied on his visor's different image settings to piece together a scene, to start a hunt, to gather information. Din's helmet was still sitting, broken, on the co-pilot seat of the Kyrick Fly. Din's head still ached where the armorer had hit him. Sometime between separating from Boba and Cronest and pacing past his fresher a few hours ago, trapped in hyperspace and wishing desperately to alter the laws of physics to get to Tatooine faster, Din had caught sight of himself in the fresher mirror. His face had bruised where she'd struck him. It wasn't as bad a bruise as it should have been, considering how hard she'd hit him. She'd taken her hammer directly to the side of Din's head. She'd bashed his helmet so hard, with such tremendous strength and with a Beskar hammer to back her up, that the seals holding his helmet in place had cracked. Not even the Dark Trooper had been able to do that, though the Dark Troopers hadn't been made of Beskar. The inside of Din's helmet had dug sharply into his cheek, his temple, but the bruise it had left was still small, a fleck of blue no bigger than a thumbprint, even though Din could still feel the aftershocks of that hammer blow every time he gritted his teeth. My helmet protected me, he thought. It couldn't protect Din now. Din had left it back on the fly, turning once to look at it before he dropped the plug door and jumped out into the sands, hitting the ground before the ramp had fully extended. His helmet had looked back at him. The metal was undented, the sharp curve of its cheek unbroken, but its visor had cracked, turned into a wishhook web of broken glass. Jin had known that he wouldn't be able to see through it, that none of his scanners, its thermal imaging, its infrared, its night vision, or its distance scope would work. The helmet was useless to Din unless he got it fixed, and now that he had walked away from Mandalore, Din didn't know anyone who could fix it. I don't need it, Din had thought. He turned away from the helmet and had leapt out into the sands, had run for the palace's great splinter doors, and now he was here, in the palace, surrounded on all sides by death and destruction. And, Din reminded himself, dragging his thoughts away from Kronest, clues. There's got to be something here that tells me what happened, where the mercs went. Part of Din still wanted to pay a visit to Mos Eisley, even though he knew that the mercs probably hadn't flown into or out of that city. Part of him wanted to knock down Amiri's door, drag Geeta into the street, make her tell Din what she knew. But she was still young, barely 20. Old enough to have taken the Foundling's trial if she'd become a child of the Watch instead of a child of Tatooine. Old enough to stand on her own as a warrior, but still hardly more than a kid. Terrifying kids wasn't how Din wanted to go about this. There's something here, he told himself, something that I can find. He had to believe that. He had to believe that his friends, his people, were still here on Tatooine somewhere, were still within Din's reach. I'd know if Boba died. The thought was new and ridiculous. Din had no way of knowing if Boba was still alive or not. He hadn't been keeping track of Boba with a tracker like Fennec had. He didn't have a readout of Boba's vitals set to show up in his visor. But I'd know. Din couldn't imagine not knowing, not being able to feel the moment Boba's life went out, snuffed like a stray ember or a spark off a Beskar forge. I know him, Din thought. I know him, and he knows me. I love him. Din stepped away from the dead Deveronian and looked at the throne room with a bounty hunter's eyes. It was easier this time. Familiar. The path of the battle was clear enough. Scorch marks on the walls, shattered tables, the lingering, biting smell of smoke. The mercenaries had come in with concussion grenades, the favorite of Joss's band of slavers. Of Gorga's crew, because the two were the same. The grenades had knocked down a great swath of people and had probably thrown everyone else in the room off balance, caused a panic. Boba wouldn't have panicked, though, and neither would Fennec or the palace guards. Boba's outfit had fought back. Din paused for a moment beside a dead human man in the same Katarn-grade armor as the Deveronian. He'd taken a blaster bolt between the eyes. Fennec, Din thought. Another merc's head had been crushed in. Boba with his Gaderfi, maybe, or Kasik with his Wookiee strength. Din kept moving. The mercs had taken heavy losses. All of them wore the same Katarn armor, dull gray, dented and chipped and singed by blaster fire. Boba's people had mounted a ferocious defense. But the defenders had also taken losses. Three Tusken warriors, all of them Shaking Mountain, identified by the patterns carved into their Gaderfi, lay dead in a heap by the mouth of one of the hallways that branched off the throne room. Tava, the fierce Twi'leki guardswoman, was dead too, slumped over the bar. Din had to step over A2, whose chassis had been crushed, photoreceptor shattered, to get closer to the throne. That was the worst of it, though. The room was full of bodies, but most of them were the bodies of mercenaries or strangers, visitors to the palace who'd been unlucky enough to get caught in the crossfire between two rival crews. Boba had dozens of palace guards and palace staff now. He had hunters on retainer and smugglers who ran for him and him alone. He had an alliance with several Tusken tribes, arrangements with over a dozen small towns and outposts. There should be more bodies, Din thought. More of our bodies, but there aren't. Boba and his people had been taken. The certainty of it swelled behind Din's ribs. He reached the throne and leaned down to touch it. The wood was cold even through Din's gloves. Of course it's cold, he told himself, chastising. The fight was hours ago. The fires have gone out. There's no one here to sit on the throne to keep it warm. Din caught a smear of dark red out of the corner of his eye, nearly invisible against the dark grain of the wood, and frowned. It's not dry, he thought, reaching out to touch it. The tips of his gloves came away tacky and red. A dark smear of blood was slashed down the side of one of the throne's arms, dripped across the floor. Boba, thought Din. He was hit. Part of Din snarled, furious, like a crate dragon scraping its claws over rocks as it roused itself from its cave. Din fought his fury down and followed the trail of droplets with his eyes. A shrapnel wound, probably. The sight of Boba's blood made bile burn at the back of Din's mouth, fury and fear tangled together, but that wasn't enough blood for Boba to have sustained a serious injury. He'd been grazed, probably, by a shard of wood flying off one of the broken tables, and then Boba had gotten up to fight. Boba was hit, Din told himself, as if repeating the words in his head could lessen their meaning, could turn all of this into a training exercise, into something harmless, into something that Din didn't have to be afraid of. Din got hurt all of the time. He survived all of it. And Boba had even more scars than Din did. Boba would survive this, too. But he wasn't hurt badly, not then. He got up, he fought. Din padded away from the throne, following the trail of blood. The drops were spaced widely apart. Boba had been moving quickly. He'd left the throne, crossed the room, and smashed into a Twi'lek mercenary. The merc had taken the sharp end of a Gedarfi through the chest. The blade had punched through his armor with tremendous force. From there, Boba had fought his way to the bar, leaving dead mercs in his wake. Din didn't know why Boba had gone for the bar. To help someone, maybe, or to take cover behind it. The bar was scorched and scored in dozens of places, the wood chipped and broken. Tava had died to defend it. Din saw that it had taken at least 7 bolts to bring her down. Behind the bar, the trail grew disordered. Drops of blood were flecked everywhere. Boba hadn't been the only one hurt. Din found 3 more dead mercenaries behind the bar. One had been killed by Boba's Gedarfi, one by a knife, and one, Din thought, by meeting the business end of one of Nura's enormous blasters at close range. Half of his head was gone. But the fight stopped here, Din realized, his heart sinking. He crouched down to get a closer look at the trail of blood and found Boba's Gedarfi underneath the bar instead. It had fallen from Boba's hand at some point during the fight and rolled, had been abandoned when the mercs had... What? Din thought, staring at the Gedarfi, trying to keep the hunter at the front of his thoughts. Dragged Boba away? Din crouched down and fished the Gedarfi out from under the bar. His fingers curled over the dark wood. He studied it, deliberately trying to keep his mind blank. It was just a weapon, just a tool. It wasn't Boba himself. Both of its ends were still tacky with half-dried blood. Din pushed a breath out, clutching the Gedarfi tightly. His fingers ached, his wrist. The Allod had hit Din in his bad arm, too, not just across the head. She'd made him drop his spear. Is that what happened to Boba? Din thought, feeling sick. But the mercs didn't take the Gedarfi with them, he thought. They took Boba, but they left this. Boba wasn't dead. He wasn't. Din clutched the Gedarfi so tightly that the joints in his wrist shrieked with red-white pain and took a breath to steady himself, trying to crush his feelings, his fear. This fight, it hadn't gone well for Boba, for the palace. Everyone was gone, which meant that they'd lost. Din had been able to see that they'd lost from Karkin's space. He couldn't change that. But I can find them, Din promised himself fiercely. I will find them. Din had been the best hunter on Navarro, the best in the Parsec. He was still a bounty hunter, still Baroya, even if he no longer hunted for the guild or for his own tribe. Din could figure out where Gorga's mercenaries had taken his friends. I can get them back, he promised himself. But I have to be careful about it. Din wouldn't do any good to any survivors if he rushed off after them and fell headfirst into a trap. Before, it had been easy in its way for Din to set himself aside and let the hunter in him do its work. Before Din had come to Tatooine, he'd been untouchable, remote. He'd done his work professionally, above any of the pleading or bribing or arguing that his targets had tried on him, and Din had gotten the job done. Grogu changed that, Din thought. Then, and Boba, Boba changed that too. It was hard to pull away from all of this, from the ruin of Boba's home, from the blood on the floor, from the evidence that Din's friends had fought for their lives, from the evidence that they'd lost. The hunter was still there in the corner of Din's mind, bright and present, but Din's focus was blurred now, cracked like his helmet. Fury inched through his chest like spreading ice. Din crushed it with some effort and made himself focus back on the trail of blood. Every second that he spent here wrestling with his feelings was another second that Gorgas Mercs could use to kill Din's friends, to load them into a shuttle and haul them off planet, to get so far away that finding them was the work of weeks, months, instead of minutes or hours. Boba dropped his Gaderfi, Din thought, still clutching the wooden weapon. So either he was knocked out or someone made him drop it. And then the fighting stopped. Din straightened up and went around to the other side of the bar, studying the floor. Behind the bar, the trail was confused, disordered by the scuffle. But on this side, the trail was clearer. The drops of blood were still spaced well apart, telling Din that whoever had been injured... He still hoped that he was following Boba, but couldn't be sure. Hadn't taken any truly serious injuries, but now, instead of droplets, the blood trail fanned out in wide, sticky smears. Drag marks, Din thought. Someone had been dragged out from behind the bar. The Mercs had left their own dead along with the palaces, so Din doubted that they'd bother to haul a wounded comrade out of the fighting. Boba, Din thought, following the smears. It has to be. Gorga would have wanted, at the very least, proof that his Mercs had killed Boba if he couldn't get his slimy hut hands on Boba alive. He would have wanted to see the body. Din, abruptly sure that he was on the right trail now, followed the blood across the throne room and down the hall. How'd they even get in? Din wondered. There were still guests in the palace when they attacked, so it's not like Fennec and Boba knew they were coming. The whole place would have been on lockdown if they'd known. So the Mercs surprised them. How had a bunch of mercenaries surprised Fennec Shand? Gorga's previous attempts to raid the palace or get rid of Boba had only served to make Fennec more paranoid. She'd been tracking all of the palace guards. She'd set it up so that she could see where the guards were all the time, so that no one could be ambushed or dragged off where they shouldn't be. Someone must have told Gorga about the trackers. If he surprised Fennec, then his Mercs knew to avoid the patrolled routes, the guarded doors. They... Another pang, half anger and half grief, rolled through Din. If the mercenaries had managed to avoid the regular patrols and made it to the throne room, if they'd known not to come into the palace through the main doors, then they had come into the palace secretly. They'd known a hidden way in. Din and Geeta, after they'd been attacked on the road, had started using the tunnels to get into and out of the palace. Geeta had been afraid of the road. She knew where the tunnels opened up out in the desert, Din thought. She knew where they opened up in the palace, too. Acid burned in his stomach. It didn't matter how the mercenaries had come into the palace. What mattered was how they'd left and who they'd taken with them. Din followed the trail of blood through the palace hallways and was not surprised to follow it all the way to the landing pad behind the palace, where he usually stored the fly, where Boba kept his own ship, where the bored nucks in attendant checked in palace visitors all day long and baked in the suns. The Nuxin was dead, too. Din stepped out of the palace into the harsh sunlight and saw him sprawled face down in the sand, his data pad still clutched in one hand. A neat, dark hole had been burned through the back of his head. Din stared at the body, throat working. He hadn't liked the Nuxin. Din had thought him too bored, too disinterested. An annoyance at best and a liability at worst. But Din hadn't wanted him to die. He hadn't deserved to die. He'd just been doing his job, minding the landing pad. The mercenaries had come this way. There was sand thrown up in every direction, clear boot prints, more blood. Din was distantly concerned about all of the blood. Back in the throne room, it hadn't seemed like Boba had been too badly hurt, but there were patches of rust-colored sand now, a churned trail. Din swallowed. The mercs hadn't taken any of the ships stored in the landing bay. Boba's battered green and red fire spray was still sitting on its landing gear, gray metal glinting through the chips in the paint. A G9 rigger had been left behind, as had a handful of other ships. The mercs didn't... They didn't take any of the ships, Din thought, wrestling himself away from the unexpected stab of grief that had punched into him at the sight of the Nuxin's body. They left all of it. So either they brought their own ships and are already in the black, or... Or they took the speeders. Finding blood in the sand was more difficult than finding blood on stone. The sands were thirsty and dry and had drunk the smaller drops and flecks that Din had been following. But following the boot prints left by a small army of mercenaries wasn't hard at all. Din skirted the Nuxin's body and found himself looking down a long, empty set of spaces where the speeders, the swoop bikes preferred by the palace's guards, Nora's Model T, the X-34s that Boba kept around for the palace's guests, the half-rusted collection of old barks that Bib Fortuna had left behind and Boba hadn't bothered to sell, were usually kept. They're all gone, Din thought. Even the crumbling old barks were gone. The mercenaries had taken just about everything that they'd been able to get started. The only things left at the very back of the bay were a pair of rusted frames and a heap of spare parts. The empty bay should have sent a spike of fear through Din's chest, but his heart leapt instead. No speeders capable of a hyperspace jump, he thought, which means that the mercs, when they left the palace, when they took Boba, were still on planet. They'd left hours ago. The mercs could have boarded a ship out in the desert somewhere, could have made a run straight for Bestine and jumped into Mobile's turnaround. They could be long gone. But they left in speeders. I can follow speeders, Din thought. He just needed a trail to follow and some transport. He thought briefly about taking either Boba's ship or the Kirik Fly and discarded both. They were both small ships, light as far as starfighters and freighters went, but they were still too big to be good trackers. Din tried his jetpack, more out of obligation than anything else, and wasn't surprised when it spluttered and refused to lift Din even an inch or two off the ground. He hadn't had the time to repair it before he'd landed on Yavin 4, and after he'd left, Din hadn't had the focus. His jetpack was as useless as his broken helmet. Which just leaves what even the mercs didn't want, Din thought. He eyed the pair of rusty frames, the heap of junk parts that the mercenaries had left behind. This is all I've got, Din thought. Unless I want to make a trip to Mos Eisley, but by the time I get back, the trail could be long gone. Already, a wind off the Great Dune Sea was shifting the sands around the palace. In another hour, the clear speeder tracks left behind by the mercenaries could be gone. Let's see what I have to work with, then. The mercenaries had left a speeder and a half behind. They'd taken everything else. Din immediately discarded the half, an old bark frame that had lost all of its wiring, its engine, and its stabilizers, and cannibalized the heap of spare parts in the hopes of getting the other speeder up and running. Din didn't have a mechanics kit on him, but the Nuxin did. He'd kept a decent kit underneath the chair he'd always been perched on. The chair was overturned in the sand, but the kit was still there. Din fished it out and got to work, propping Boba's Gaderfi up against the wall. The Razor Crest had been a flying heap of scrap metal and Jawa-rigged wires, torn apart and put back together half a dozen times, so Din was a decent mechanic by necessity. The speeder he was working with, a truly hideous Zephyr G that looked like it had seen the rise and fall of more than just one empire, was barely worth the price of its bolts, but it was all that Din had to work with, and the heap of spare parts had what he needed, more or less. The old bark looked like Womp Rats or Urusai had been inside it, chewing at its wires, but it had two engine coils that were still usable. Din scavenged those, a spark plug and a repulsor from the scrap pile, and some wire insulation from his own jetpack, since it was just extra weight to him now anyway, and allowed himself a faint, satisfied grin when he shoved the last engine coil into place with the heel of his hand and flicked the ignition. The Zephyr G coughed three times, the engine crackling, black smoke churning up from its belly, and spluttered to life. That'll work, Din thought. Its paint job was peeling, its engine case was scratched, its seat had been chewed down to scraps of leather, probably by the same hungry animal that had helped itself to the insides of the old bark. But its engine rumbled and held, the repulsors kicked in, the bike lifted. In any other circumstance, the sound of the speeder would have Dan shutting it down and towing it into the nearest mechanic's shop, ready to drop a few hundred credits to gut the thing and start over. He didn't have time to get to Pelimoto, though, and he didn't have time to worry about the swoop bike. It would work or it wouldn't. Dan only needed it to get him to the Mercs anyway. He planned on taking at least one of Boba's speeders back. Dan tossed the tools back where he'd found them, left his useless jetpack in the sands, and strapped Boba's Gaderfi to the side of the Zephyr. He intended to give it back to Boba in person. He swung a leg up over the side of the bike, then hesitated. It felt wrong to leave the Nuxin out here to rot. The dead inside would keep for a little while longer, but out here the Urusai would be at the Nuxin within a few hours. Din didn't have time to bury him, but he could at least cover his body. He could do that much for one of Boba's people. The Nuxin had been more than useless, but... But he was one of us, thought Dan. Before he could talk himself out of it, Din loped back over to the place where the Nuxin had fallen, shed his cloak, and draped it carefully over the corpse, tucking the edges underneath the body so that Din's cloak wouldn't blow away with the first gust of strong wind. It was a miserable effort, but it would at least keep the Kyrick flies away for a few hours. Then Din set his grief aside and climbed back up onto the Zephyr G. It wobbled under his weight, but the repulsors worked all right. Din stayed above the sand. He took one last look at the palace's landing bay, at Boba's fire spray and the Nuxin's body, and then Din left, following the wide thrown furrows left in the sand as they led him out into the open desert. He could see the palace and the swoop bike's mirrors. White smoke still poured from the gouge in the throne room's roof, and a hole punched into Boba's tower was billowing black. That plume of smoke grew smaller and smaller, then wavered and vanished into the desert's heat. Din struck a course north and west, aimed for the Jundland wastes. The speeder tracks carved through the dunes confirmed his course. One speeder could pass through the desert without kicking up enough sand to leave a trail, but the Mercs had taken at least 24 speeders and transports. The desert looked like a herd of Bantha had stormed through it. Din slung himself low over the swoop and urged it along as fast as he dared. He wanted to gain some ground. The engine groaned, roaring like an angry crate, spitting smoke, but it kept going. There's something to be said for pre-imperial scrap, Din thought grimly, remembering the Razor Crest, as the desert whirled by in shades of red and orange. The ridges were bare. Din passed a pair of Bantha, both laden with the Tusken Scout's usual provisions and gear that had been slaughtered underneath a stone outcropping. The red rock rose like a bloody hand over the corpses. Din didn't have to stop to know that the Bantha's riders were dead along with their mounts. Gorga probably knew which tribes had allied themselves with Boba, he thought. His men knew to watch the ridges, to take out any scouts or outriders that they saw. The Spotted Anuba, the Shaking Mountain, the Sun Rock. His mercs would have killed anyone that they came across. Din wondered how coordinated Gorga's attacks had been. They must have occurred pretty close together if the Mercs had taken the palace, Mos Pelgo, and the Tuskens out altogether. Concern lurched through Din's chest, quickly followed by anger. Din had been adopted by the White Bantha, but he'd liked Ashek, Ushib. They'd been Din's allies. The Sun Rock, too. The Sun Rock probably got hit, Din thought. Spotted Anuba's territories across the Great Dune Sea from here. Ashek and his people, they scouted for us, but they're deep enough in the sands that they might have been left alone. But the Sun Rock, Mos Pelgo. Worry gnawed at Din. We knew that there was a hole in Cobb Vanth's network. The first job Din had ever done for the Ahra, for Cobb, running a group of escaping slaves between Tatooine and Boss Pity, had gone sideways. A gang of Trandoshan slave hunters had been waiting for them in the skies above Boss Pity. But we thought that was, what, bad luck? Din wondered. He set himself in the middle of the wide tracks left by Gorga's soldiers and followed them, picking up speed. Dunes whipped by, their backs broken by more dead Banthas, by destroyed hunter-killers, and the outcroppings of rock grew larger and more frequent. The palace was gone now, lost miles behind Din, and the deep canyons of the Jundland Wastes were rising ahead. The Mercs had covered a lot of ground very quickly. They'd had to, because the Tusken scouts who died near the palace hadn't had time to warn the scouts closer to the wastes. Tuscans didn't use comms, but they had their ways of communicating over vast distances. None of the scouts had had time to reach their talking drums. They didn't get the chance, Din thought, racing past another dead bantha. His fingers itched to stop and honor the dead. Din wasn't superstitious, not really, and even though Grogu could do incredible things with the Force, that didn't mean that the superstition surrounding the creations of the Rushiri, the Atikat, the evil spirits of the desert, the Revenants, which were said to prowl the sands at night and devour the unwary, were true. Elhama, the Jita of the White Bantha, who'd taken Din into her own tent when Ustak and Ahaza had dragged him in, half-dead, from the desert, had told Din that to let a warrior walk the star road while their bones lay above the sand was to condemn that warrior's spirit to fall back to the earth. The bones were an anchor, and to walk the star road, Tarimanzi, a spirit had to be untethered, had to be set free. But there's no time. I'll come back when this is finished, when everyone is home safe, when I've gotten Boba back. And, well, if I die, thought Din, then I want the huts to be haunted. I don't want them to be safe in the sands ever again. That conviction burned through him. It was the twin to the cold rage still lodged behind Din's chest, and its opposite, too. Din wasn't sure if the feeling was a Tusken feeling or a Mandalorian one. If the urge to hunt his enemies down even in death was an extension of the life Din had lived here in the desert or the one he'd lived in the stars. The words of the Rezalnare echoed in his head. Aranov Alit. Those were the first words of the Rezalnare that Din had ever heard. Self-defense. Clan. Haunting the desert as a fire spirit or a revenant wasn't self-defense, wasn't honoring the clan. But if the clan had been killed, keeping their murderers from peace seemed like the least that Din could do. The surety of it seared him to the bone. Is that Mandokar? Mandatorim, Din wondered. Mandalorian righteousness, the right thing to think, to do? If it was, Din could understand now why there were so few Mandalorians left. Why Kreese was the way that she was, why she burned for vengeance even though she still had people alive who needed her. The pull of vengeance was strong. It tugged at Din even now, hooked into his belly, rooted behind his ribs. No, he thought, with some effort. He skimmed over another dead bantha. This one's rider had died in the saddle. The sand all around it was dark with blood. The corpses swarmed with fist-sized Kyrick flies. No, Din thought. Vengeance. Vengeance later, if I have to pursue it. I'm angry. I want the huts to pay. But my feelings don't matter. What matters is saving whoever is still alive. Of all of the bodies that Din had passed since he'd left the palace, none of them had belonged to anyone that Din knew. He hadn't seen any more palace guards, hadn't seen Fennec tossed to lie beneath a sand dune or Nora by a ridge. He hadn't seen any of Boba's armor scattered across the sand. Some of them are still alive, Din told himself, repeating the conclusion he'd drawn back in the throne room. He urged the Zephyr G even faster. The canyons had risen up ahead. And since they're still alive, my priority is to get them out, get them safe. Then, Din thought, we can think about vengeance. The suns had just reached their highest point in the sky when Din, still following the clear tracks of the mercenary caravan, reached the canyons. The annual Bantha migration was over now, which meant that the Tuscans' hunting season inside the Jundland Wastes was over, too. Din wasn't surprised to have followed the tracks back here, either. The wastes were where the mercenaries had staged their first raid on the palace. It made sense that they'd staged their attack from the canyons again, that they'd retreated to the canyons when their attack had been successful. Din's speeder threw an echoing roar up against the walls of the canyon. He reluctantly racked the swoop down to a more reasonable speed, and the roar faded to an uneven, coughing growl. Vengeance aside, there was no reason for Din to broadcast his position so openly. Gorga's army had come to Tatooine well-stocked, since they'd managed to overrun the palace. Din was going to need every advantage that he could get if he intended to get his people back. With any luck, the raiders would think that Din was still off-world, that he hadn't known about the attack. Din had told Geeta that he was leaving, but he hadn't told her when he'd be back. He hung on to his speeder and started scanning the trail more carefully, looking for more subtle signs instead of just the general direction of the caravan. Even though the suns were at their highest point in the sky above Din, shadows still lay thick at the bottom of the canyons. The banded rock wound deeper into the heart of the wastes, sinuous and cool, the canyon narrowed. Jalto hadn't known where he was going when Din had followed him into the junglands all those weeks ago, but evidently Gorga's outfit had figured out a better route. Their track never wavered. No one branched off from the main caravan, Din thought, passing the shadowed mouths of other paths carved through the rock. That was good. Din had no way of knowing which speeder had carried Boba, so if some had branched off from the rest, Din would have had to pick a trail to follow. He was relieved that he didn't have to choose. The mercenaries' trail stayed together, one great line of disturbed sand, and followed the trunk of the largest canyon, even as other paths branched away. I might even be gaining some ground. The mercs had left the palace quickly, had covered a broad swath of the desert without stopping or leaving any sign of their passing but for the speeder tracks and other bodies. But now, sheltered by the high walls of the canyons, Din was starting to see signs that the mercs had slowed down. Discarded canteens, too shiny and new to be leftovers from a Tusken hunting band, lined the tracks. Empty blaster cartridges dotted the sands. At least one speeder had stopped to deal with an engine problem. Din passed a pearly puddle of grease that had been left to soak in the sands. Din still didn't find any more of his people's bodies. That was good, an encouraging sign, grim as it was. If any of the palace's people had died on the trip out here, the raiders would have just pushed their bodies off to the side like they'd done with the Tusken scouts and their empty canteens. But the mercs hadn't thrown anyone off to the side. They'd stopped, had water, fixed the faulty engine. They'd started to move again. The canyon grew narrower and narrower as Din followed it, the shadows deepening as the sun swung west of the jungle wastes. He could see where and when the mercenary caravan had been forced to start traveling closer together. Four speeders riding side by side, then three, then two, until the canyon narrowed so sharply that even Din was taking his turns carefully to avoid bashing his elbow or the nose of his swoop bike into the rocks. The sandstone here was streaked with soot and carbon. Din wondered how close he was to the staging area that he'd found after the first raid. The smooth, flat canyon top, the smuggler's route carved out of the walls. Din had traveled over the wastes by jetpack that time and had been able to see where he was in relation to the rest of the canyons. Din had no idea where he was now, except that he was tracking northeast. The canyon was so narrow now that not even cedar trees had managed to get their roots into the sand, and Din could see streaks of orange and yellow paint on the rocks where the larger land speeders had scraped against the walls. He made it another 100 yards or so, the canyon twisting and turning, before his swoop bike nosed out into a much wider space, like a clearing in the middle of a forest, and Din nearly ran over Kashyyyk's body. He managed to avoid Kashyyyk at the last second by jerking the Zephyr hard to the right, nearly overbalancing the thing. Din got it stabilized without wrecking it, heart hammering, and pulled off to the side of the newly wide canyon underneath the shadow of the rock, so he could look back. The body was already partially buried in the sand, but it was Kashyyyk's. Din recognized the black fur, the size. Heart-sinking, he shut the swoop bike off, aware that he might not get it started again, and climbed off of it when it came to rest in the sand. Din checked the canyon walls on either side, looking for a scout or an enemy, then crossed over to Kashyyyk's body when he determined that it was safe enough. Din crouched down beside Kashyyyk, grief rising again, and gently turned him over. Kashyyyk's eyes were closed. His expression was calm. His fur was singed in a dozen places, and he had at least two large blaster wounds. He'd been bound with mag cuffs, but at some point Kashyyyk must have broken free. The cuffs were still wrapped around Kashyyyk's wrists, but they weren't connected anymore, and there were bright silver bits of metal half-buried in the sand 20 or 30 paces past where Kashyyyk had fallen. Din closed his eyes. He got free, Din thought. He made himself stand up. He could see what had happened. The sand was disordered, clean tracks thrown into disarray. But if Din had been the leader of a large caravan of mercenaries coming out of the narrower canyon one by one, he would have pulled up and waited for the rest of his band. The desert was often hostile, and while the Mercs had killed several Tuscans, anyone who'd spent any time on Tatooine knew that there were always more. The caravan had paused, stopped to reorder itself, for the Mercs to get a drink of water, check their heading, anything. Din couldn't read the sands well enough to tell, but he wouldn't have been surprised if more Mercs, outriders, scouts, additional bands that had gone after Mos Pelgo or some of Boba's other allies, had come from elsewhere to join up with the main caravan. Kasik had seen the caravan pause, and he'd seen an opportunity. Din didn't have anything to cover him with, so he settled for dragging Kasik's body into the shade, grunting as the weight made Din's injuries from Crow Nest ache and complain, and covering him loosely with sand. The thought of leaving him out in the suns to bake felt just as wrong as the thought of leaving the Nuxin had, so Din allowed himself the handful of minutes it took to get Kasik out of the suns. Then he looked around at the rest of the canyon, trying to figure out what had happened next. There weren't any other bodies, which told Din that Kasik's rebellion had been the worst of it. Din's luck had run out, too. Up until this particular canyon, the mercenaries had traveled all in one caravan together. But there were half a dozen wide canyons branching off of this one, and speeder tracks vanishing down all of them. The sand had been flung up in every direction, he couldn't even tell which tracks were coming and which were going. Kark, Din thought. He wanted to kick something, but only had sand or his battered speeder, and if he kicked the speeder, he was half convinced that it would fall apart on him. Din blew out another breath and shaded his eyes, looking at the walls around him to see if there was anything he could use to figure out which set of tracks to follow. At first, he saw only the red walls of the canyon cliffs, featureless enough to look the same from a distance. The rock was layered in bands of yellow and orange and red that wrapped around the walls for as far as Din could see, and the cliff sides were still and quiet. Din could almost imagine the river that had been here once, still and deep and slow, carving its way through the rock with fathomless patience. But he couldn't see where Boba had been taken. Din shook his head, irritated and upset, more affected by Kasik's death than he thought that he would be, and looked harder. The speeder tracks were too confused to even begin to make sense of who went where, and Din still had no way of knowing which speeder had carried Boba. I need access to Fennec's trackers, Din thought, unless the Mercs took them all out. Din hadn't seen Fennec's holoprojector or her datapad in the wreckage back at the palace, though, which meant that he had to do this the old-fashioned way. Focus, he told himself. Din set his hands at his hips and squinted up at the sky. His fingers brushed against the darksaber, which was a comforting weight against his side. A Junda bird soared against the blue. I don't have Fennec's map, Din thought, an idea sparking in his mind. But if I can get up high, I can see the canyons laid out like one. Maybe Din would be able to see if the mercenaries had made camp anywhere, or if they'd left a more obvious sign of their passing. The desert beyond the canyons was pretty flat. From up high, Din would be able to see for miles, even without his helmet. It was a better plan than any Din had been able to come up with so far. Din left Kasik's body and his effigy and the speeder tracks behind, making for the canyon walls. Other places in the canyons had been used by slavers, by Joss's crew, to stage mercs and to avoid enforcement of Boba's rules against slavery. The slavers had cut pathways down to the bottom of the canyons, built tracks up the sides to reach the plateaus. And the mercs, they stopped here for a reason, Din thought. Maybe they even rallied here if there were multiple raiding parties. They must have done that for a reason. They know this place, so... So, Din thought, as he loped up and down the edges of the canyon, searching for any small glint of metal he could find. There was a good chance that there was a pathway up to the plateaus from here. Even a route up to a sniper's perch or a scout's nest. All Din needed was some height. Din went 100 paces north from the tangle of feeder tracks, then turned and went 100 paces south. Moving south on the eastern wall of the canyon, Din finally found a small, cherrick-shaped piece of metal that had been bolted deep into the rock. The metal was old, durasteel probably, and flecked with rust. It was about the size of Din's foot, no wider than the span of his hand, but Din had heard the tales of how the canyons had been formed from the Tuscans. Durasteel rungs were not part of that story. Smugglers, Din thought. He looked up. Sure enough, 3 feet above the first Cherrick post was a second, and 3 feet above that was a third. The posts rose up and up over Din's head, just like the first metal ladder Din had found. They stopped at a cliff that hung nearly all the way up at the top of the canyon. Din could just barely see the shadow of a second, higher cliff beyond the first. Satisfaction thrilled through Din, darker than it usually was. He'd found a way up. I don't know how old these are, though, Din thought. He didn't know how long it had been bolted to the canyon wall. He didn't have his jetpack. A fall from any height could kill Din, and then no one would be able to help his friends except the Jedi, and Din didn't know when Voss would be able to make it to Tatooine or where he'd go when he landed. Wary, Din wrapped a hand around one of the durasteel rungs and tugged. The metal was as thick around as Din's thumb and held. He couldn't even jostle it. Whoever had set the metal rungs into the rock had known what they were doing. Aware that falling had more consequences than it usually did, Din heaved himself up and began to climb. He tested each rung before he put his full weight on it, since a man in Beskar weighed more than the average Tusken or light-running slaver, but Din was aware, too, that being cautious was costing him time. Hand over hand, Din scrambled up the side of the canyon. By the time he reached the first plateau, Din was glad that most of the vertigo that had plagued him after his encounter with a dark trooper had healed. He was easily 500 feet above the bottom of the canyon. The second plateau was only 25 or 30 feet above the first, set 30 feet back. The durasteel rungs continued up the side of the second cliff, too. Din had a pretty good view from the first plateau. He could see the shape of the nearby canyons, at least, and could track the veins and arteries carved out of the rock. But he wanted to see how close he was to the edge of the Jundland Wastes. Din went up the second set of rungs to the top of the canyon, then shaded his eyes. There were taller plateaus and mesas around, but not many. Din was near the edge of the Jundland Wastes. He was maybe a click from the edge of the outermost band of canyons, the Dune Sea rolling away into the distance. Din could see east for miles until the white and yellow sands were lost into the blue haze of the sky. Other buttes and juts of rock reared up in the sands. Muspelgo's that way, Din thought, squinting. The suns were still bright and fierce. The air shimmered with heat. The glare off Din's armor caught in his eyes. Din couldn't see the town from here, of course, not without a distance scope, but he knew where it was. He frowned. So what did the Mercs attack first, he wondered, the palace or Muspelgo? Both had been attacked, otherwise Vanth would have picked up when Din had calmed, and Gorga wouldn't have just turned the Ahra against Boba. If they attacked the palace first, did they drag everyone along to make them watch the Mercs raise Muspelgo next? Din's thoughts broke off, instinct screaming a warning. He heard the shot before he saw it, a high, resonating thwomp, the thrum of a pulse charge burning through the air. The hairs on the back of Din's neck lifted. He didn't have time to dodge the bolt completely, but Din lunged forward and managed to avoid taking a pulse charge directly to the head. The bolt caught him in the back at an angle, clanging off of his cuirass and sending Din spinning to the ground. He landed hard on his side, breath driven away. His teeth rattled from the impact. His right arm, which Din had thrown out to catch himself as he'd spun, shrieked with pain. His back, where he'd taken the brunt of the impact, ached. Hot rock seared the side of his face. The one good thing about a pulse rifle, from the perspective of the person getting shot at least, was that even the most cutting-edge models could only hold one charge in the barrel at a time, and that meant that Din had a handful of seconds to decide what to do before his attacker took another shot at him. There was no time left for pain. Din tucked his head in and kept rolling, trying to gauge the direction of the shot. Rolling turned out to be a good idea. The second plasma charge slammed into the rock where Din had been just heartbeats before, pulverizing stone, and now Din knew where the shots were coming from. Kirk the Darksaber, he thought, springing up to his feet. Kirk the spear, too. I should have traded them both in for a fire puncher. Din didn't have any long-range weapons on him. Not since he'd lost the Amban on Tython. He had a blaster, and he was a good shot with it, but it had only the third of a range of a decent rifle. Din had no chance of hitting his attacker, not at a distance. That has never stopped me before, Din thought. Bringing his head up, Dan caught sight of the pulse rifle as it fired again, plasma flaring wide against the flat blue sky. This time, Dan managed to keep his feet, leaping aside, and the bolt screamed over his head. He narrowed his eyes. Only a third of a click, he thought, not as far away as Dan had feared. He could shoot pretty accurately over 1,000 feet or so, and did just that, drawing his own blaster between the third bolt of plasma and the fourth, firing back. Din's blaster grew warm in his hand. He didn't have to wait between charges to load another, not like the enemy with a pulse rifle did, and fired off 5 shots in quick succession, his red bolts nearly invisible in the bright light. His enemy was big, Trandoshan, Din thought. Greenish-brown, nearly the same color as the sands, draped in a reddish poncho to hide better among the rocks. A scout? If the Trandoshan was one of Gorga's mercs, that could mean that the rest of the mercenary band was camped out nearby. It was hard to travel in the heat of the day, after all. The band of mercenaries could be waiting for dusk to start moving through the desert again. If the mercenaries were close by, Din wanted the Trandoshan alive. Cold focus took over, transforming the adrenaline that thundered through Din's body into battle calm. He fired again, leaning out of the way of another shrieking plasma charge, and shot the Trandoshan in the knee. The Trandoshan stumbled. He didn't stop shooting back at Din, but his next shot did swing wide, giving Din plenty of room to avoid it. Trandoshans were hard to drop, though. Their size and their tough hides gave them plenty of protection from blaster fire. They were stubborn, too, and tenacious. Din had always hated hunting them. He fired again, this time catching the Trando in the side, but the merc just kept coming. Kark, Din thought, backing up. He wanted to put room between himself and the pulse rifle, but he didn't have room any further back, and Din would be at the edge of the canyon, teetering over the lip of the cliff, and he had left his jetpack behind. Din couldn't bolt away across the sky, not this time. But the closer the Trandoshan got to Din, the harder his pulse charges would hit. At least he's alone, Din thought, firing again. The Trandoshan ducked and stumbled, clawed feet catching on the rocks. Din took that split second of opportunity to empty his spent clip and reload. Would the Darksaber be able to help? Din wondered. He knew enough of Form 3 now to deflect blaster bolts, after all. He'd done it in Gela's place, squaring off against Jassa and her crew. A pulse charge hit a lot harder, but Din thought the principle was the same. A high guard, a quick deflection. The Trandoshan mercenary didn't give Din the chance to try the Darksaber and find out. He recovered from his stumble, leveled the pulse rifle, and shot Din directly in the chest. It hurt. Fennec had once shot Din with a similar rifle from 2 clicks out and knocked him back on his ass. The Trandoshan hit Din from 400 feet and bowled him over, the energy of the bolt throwing him down onto the ground and sending Din toppling onto his back. His Beskar held, though. It was ringing and vibrating against Din's chest like a ship about to fly apart coming down into the atmosphere, pain reverberating in his chest, his belly. But it held. Din didn't fall off the edge, either. Not quite. The force of the charge sent him tumbling towards the edge of the cliff, and gravity did the rest, hooking Din over the side, but instinct kicked in, and he scrambled for a handhold, clinging to the edge of the cliff with all his strength. Din's ears rang. He felt the planet pulling at him. He lost his blaster over the side of the cliff and heard it clatter down against the rocks below. Kark, Din thought, scrambling for purchase. He tried to dig his nails into the rock, but his gloves wouldn't let him. The pads of his fingers were too smooth. He slipped further. Calm down, Din told himself sternly, years of training and experience kicking in. Struggling wildly was only going to make things worse. Din stopped flailing and tried to find purchase with his feet, boots scraping. He slid another inch towards the edge of the cliff, and his armor whined, spitting white sparks as it dragged against the sandstone. Come on, Din thought. He found a jut of rock and tried to brace his foot against it, but the rock complained underneath his weight and gave way. Come on. The Trandoshan, limping a little but still enormous, made it to the edge of the cliff. His clawed feet appeared at the edges of Din's vision. Din looked up at him. The Trandoshan peered down, the look in his yellow eyes almost curious. He was panting from pain or exertion or both. A mouth full of sharp teeth on display. And up close, Din could see that the Trandoshan was older, battle-scarred, with a tough hide and a faded yellow kit tucked underneath his sandstone-colored poncho. Din thought that he recognized the Trandoshan. This one was a bounty hunter. Din might have seen him across a guild cantina once or twice. Din had wounded him, which at least gave Din a bright flash of fierce satisfaction. He had managed to wound his killer. At least Din had gone down fighting. That thought was Mandalorian through and through. Paz would have been proud to hear it. The Allure, if she was still alive. If she'd survived Din putting the darksaber through her side. Din's bad arm was screaming at him. His fingers spasmed and his grip on the rock slipped again. His own weight, the weight of his Beskar, dragged Din inexorably down. The Trandoshan's tongue flickered out, tasting the air. Din had put a hole in the Trandoshan's leg, in his side. The Trandoshan slung his pulse rifle back over his shoulder, which seemed like a mistake to Din, then set one heavy clawed foot on Din's left hand. "You know," said the Trandoshan, drawing out his words in the characteristic hissing rasp of his species, "I almost feel bad about this." The look in his flat, yellow eyes was considering, curious in a cold, spare sort of way, like the Trandoshan was wondering what would happen next, but didn't have too much invested in the outcome. Din bared his teeth back in a wordless snarl. He wasn't going to beg. The Trandoshan hissed, half admiring, and bore down with all of his weight. Din snarled. Agony flared behind his eyes. The Trandoshan pressed down on Din's hand until Din gave in. His grip failed, all of the fingers and tendons in his left hand screaming, and Din tore his hand away with a cry. His entire weight fell onto his bad hand. The Trandoshan didn't have to step on that hand. Din's right hand had been weaker than his left ever since the Dark Trooper had broken his arm on the light cruiser. It wouldn't have held Din for long, even if the Armorer hadn't struck him there during their fight on Kronest. "Stubborn," the Trandoshan remarked. His tongue flickered out again. He could probably taste Din's pain in the air. "Get carked," Din spat back. His bad hand finally failed him, too. Din lost his grip, and he fell. And the last thing that he heard before Din hit the rock below was the Trandoshan laughing, a hissing sound that rose above the wind, which rushed past Din's ears and, too soon, cut off. Din hit the first plateau feet first, staying conscious for long enough to register the impact, his right leg buckling, agony exploding like a star behind Din's eyes. And then Din knew nothing at all. In his dreams, Din was a child again. 7 or 8 years old, small for his age, the smallest of his cousins, but the sneakiest. It had been Din who'd snuck away from the day's work, bringing the Gualama flocks in from the summer pastures to go down to the river and look for his cousin Kida's lucky Kura stone instead. She'd lost it playing Warana's coming the day before, and if she couldn't find it before the floods came, her Kura stone would be washed away and lost forever. In his dreams, Din slipped away to find it for her. It was easy. Din's parents, his aunts and uncles, everyone in the village was focused on getting the Gualamas down from the high meadows before the rains came. Moving the Gualamas was a job that took everyone, so the entire village was out to help, even the cousins. Din had 18 cousins, a proper flock of them on their own, even without any Gualamas in the mix. No one noticed one little boy in red slip away from the rest, and Din darted down from the high meadows, passing the worn, moss-covered fence post that marked the field, the little shrines Din's aunts prayed to, the tall ridge of banded red sandstone, and jumped down into the lower fields, aiming for the river. The sky above Din was iron gray, Beskar gray, the gray of a coming rain. Din could taste the water in the air. Wind ruffled his hair, rushed past his ears, and laughed to itself, high and hissing. Din loved the rainy season. Sure, it got boring sometimes, stuck inside for days at a time while the wind and rain lashed the village. But every night when the rains quieted, the whole town would pile into Din's grandfather's house and tell stories. They played games, they brought out their spiciest merica sauce and tried to make their neighbors cry, or at least to make them rush outside and gulp fresh rainwater straight from the overflowing cisterns in Din's grandfather's courtyard. Last year, Din's oldest cousins had spiked Din's merica sauce with chifu peppers and had been surprised when Din had gone back for more. He could still remember Capron's face, his eyebrows climbing up towards his hair. That had been fun. And after the rains finished, the clouds would disappear and the night sky would be full of stars. Din's mother would take him outside and make shapes out of them and tell him stories about those shapes. Din liked that, too. Din dropped down the mossy terrace into the nearest ua field, grinning to himself, pleased with his own cleverness. Now that he was out of sight, no one would find him until Din was ready for them to find him. He leapt from ua field to ua field, only stumbling a little over large, sandy red rocks and thick green vines, and quickly forgot that he should be bigger. In Din's dream, the ua stalks closed like hands over his head and hid him from the shepherds, and he liked feeling safe underneath them. The red rocks and tangling vines were strange, too, and he kept tripping over them, but the ua stalks were just right, the smell of them dusty and golden. And Din soon forgot about the strangeness of the vines and the red rocks, just like he forgot the feeling of being taller, being stronger, walking around with armor heavy on his shoulders, his head, instead of a spun red tunic. When he reached the edge of the ua fields, Din jumped easily down into the river valley, trading the dry golden ua stalks for the red river reeds. Up in the high meadows, he could hear the gualamas calling, a thin, squeaking sound, undercut by a deeper groan that made Din think of an animal that was much bigger than a gualama, shaggier, covered from head to toe in long brown hair. Seeds clouded into the air all around Din. He ran his fingers over the soft heads of the reeds and smiled when their seeds tried to follow him. They stuck to Din's hair, to his clothes. Din sneezed, startling a bright flock of isu birds and one fat, unhappy urusai into the sky, and pushed his way through the reeds to the river. A belly bird whooped overhead. There were more red rocks down here, a huge swath of golden sand, a few worn steps that looked like they might have belonged to Din's village, but reminded him of something else. Pyramids, he thought, half-draped in vines like the old aunties draped shawls over their shoulders, their hair. There was a trick to moving through the reeds without getting cut on the edges of the stalks. Din had forgotten it out in the waking world, just like he'd forgotten how it felt to be this small, how it felt to feel safe outside of his armor. Like he'd forgotten that all of the rocks in the valleys around his village had been white and gray, not red, and how he had never seen sand so golden until he'd gone to Tatooine. But Din remembered now how to move through the reeds. There was a trick to it. It had taken Din a while to learn when he'd been a kid. It had taken all of his cousins a while to learn, too. Learning how to move through the reeds was part of growing up. Din pulled his sleeves down over his fingertips. The fabric of his shirt was soft and warm. Gualama fiber, braided and woven here in Din's own village. They dyed it red with reed stalks in the spring. There were holes in Din's sleeves, black blaster burns singed through the cloth, leaving his shirt pocked and tattered. Din didn't remember getting shot at. He tugged his hood up to protect his cheeks, then ducked his face down to avoid catching a reed across the forehead or his nose, where a very old scar itched between his eyes. Strange, Din thought. I didn't have a scar there when I was a kid. The strangeness was easy to let go, though. Din's dream was soft and round with comfortable familiarity. Din let the strangeness slip through his fingers, and it was distant within a second, gone within the next. He brushed the reeds aside as he walked, using his sleeves to protect himself from their sharp edges. A parade of floating seeds marched down to the river with Din. He kept his eyes on the ground. Kida's lucky currystone was green, which was why it was lucky. Most currystones were gray or blue. The ground itself was soft and well-trampled. There was plenty of gray and blue to look at. Dozens of helmets were buried in the mud, lost among the reeds, their visors cracked, new shoots sprouting up through holes in their foreheads, their cheeks. Din and his cousins had done most of the trampling. They'd come down here yesterday and played Warana's Coming for hours, hiding from Kida's older brother, Ayuluka, who was one of the best Warana's in the whole village. Ayuluka never managed to find Din, but he'd caught Kida and Lyra both and tossed them, squealing with laughter, into the river. Maybe I'll be big enough to be Warana next year, Din thought, searching the turned-over earth. He brushed aside some trampled reeds, kicking over a chunk of dusty sandstone, stepped over a burned, muddy roll of woven cloth, and brushed aside the faint knowledge that it would take Din another 3 years to hit his growth spurt. The knowledge, like the sandstone and the roll of burned cloth, had no place here. It was easy to ignore. "I'm not as fast as Iuluka is, probably," Din thought, "but if I practice sneaking, maybe I can..." There. Kida's Kura stone glittered in the mud by the riverbank just beyond the reeds. It had been pushed deep into the mud, probably by someone's shoe, and now only one side of it, smeared with dirt, could be seen. But the side that Din could see was green, so it couldn't be an ordinary Kura stone, it had to be Kida's. Din grinned. Kida had been sad about her missing stone all day. She'd be happy when Din brought it back to her. Din stepped out of the reeds and let his hood fall back down. He dug the stone out of the mud and studied it. He was pretty sure that it was Kida's, but it was hard to be certain with all of the mud. The stone glimmered in Din's hand. It had looked green from the reeds, but now it almost looked blue, translucent and shiny, like a piece of the sky. It was warm against Din's fingers. Din thought that he even saw a fleck of copperite or bronzium on one side, a sharp angular edge, which couldn't be right. Kura stones were always blue or green or gray. Din eyed the river. Some water would help Din get a better look, but there was a tug of trepidation low in Din's belly now, a pang of warning. Something bad was about to happen. Din stared at the river, confused, and that feeling faded. He relaxed. There was nothing to be afraid of, not from the river. Every child in Din's village was taught how to swim almost before they were taught to walk. They were mountain people, mostly, and they spent most of their time in the high meadows with their Gualama flocks. But the river was part of the mountain, too, and when the floods came, everyone had to swim. Din wasn't afraid of the water. The river was still and quiet anyway. Summers on Akvatina were hot and dry. The river was so still that it was almost a lake. Its banks were crowded with reeds, and half a dozen bodies bobbed peacefully in the water. The only thing Din would have to worry about if he waded in was irritating a Filumilu, but he didn't see any snake tracks by the water anyway, just a broad, enormous rut left by a trailing tail far too large to be Filumilu, and the Filumilu were scared of people anyway. There was nothing to be afraid of. The spike of nervousness that Din felt looking at the water was distant, and it didn't belong, just like the vague idea that Din would take a few years to grow didn't belong, or the idea that the Kura stone had had a strip of bronzium running across its face. Din let his nervousness go and stepped into the water. The water was warm, gentle. It wouldn't go cold and wild until the floods came. Din waded in up to his knees, careful to avoid the bodies, and bent down to rinse Kida's stone off in the water. The bodies bobbed gently beside him. The nearest belonged to a Blackford Wookiee and to a Twi'lek who had only one leku, but there were others too. The bodies of children in tan robes, the bodies of men and women in spun red tunics, of people in armor, like the helmets that had been half buried in the mud and overgrown with reeds. Din ignored them, focusing on the Kura stone in his palm. It wasn't Kida's, it couldn't be. Kida's stone was small and round, its edges worn smooth by nervous fingers. And the stone in Din's hand was bigger than it should be and sharp-edged. It wasn't green either, but blue, and there was bronzium in it, inlaid into grooves in the stone, and the face of the stone was smooth. Din crouched down, frowning. Nervousness spiked in his gut again, almost like a hand laid on Din's shoulder, like a voice whispering, "Look, Mandalorian." But that couldn't be right, because Din wasn't a Mandalorian, not yet. He was only a child playing by the riverbank. And in the back of his mind, Din remembered this day. He remembered it as soon as he saw the strange shape go rippling across the smooth surface of the river, as soon as the wind turned and the Kura stone, the holocron, slipped from his fingers. The shape moving across the water was black like a rock, like freshly turned soil, but Din could tell that it wasn't a rock. The shape shimmered and its edges blurred, which meant that it was a reflection, not a shape. The real shape was in the sky. Din had seen some truly enormous birds sailing through the skies above the village, but he'd never seen a bird that just hung there, suspended in the sky like it was waiting for something. The nervousness, the fear, was rising now, strong and cold as a rain-swollen river. The stone Din had found sank and sank, disappearing into dark water, and the body sank too. Din looked up. An enormous black shape hung there in the sky, a strange circular monster that Din knew, without ever having seen one that size before, was a spaceship. While Din watched it, 100 smaller black shapes shook away from the larger ship, clotting up like seeds drifting above the river reeds, and began to streak across the sky. They moved like glitter bees, Din thought in his dream, a child's confusion meeting a warrior's memory. No, he thought, watching the shape streak towards the village. His village. Towards the golden Uwa fields, overgrown now with long dark vines, with Misasi trees that shuddered at the ship's passing, with red sandstone ridges already crumbling. Towards the green Gualama meadows, bubbling now with Nivaran magma. Towards the houses clustered together up high on the hill, the familiar towers of a palace far away, the white mud houses of Tatooine, the old pyramids of Yavin 4. Red light was building in the mouths of those shapes, and even from the bottom of the river, Din could smell carbon burning. He could hear the screaming start. They're not glitter bees. Din remembered this day now. He knew what was about to happen. He knew how this day ended. He started to run. Din woke up, with red light stamped across the backs of his eyelids, hard in his mouth, arms and legs stinging with dozens of half-remembered reed cuts, shallow and bloodless. For a second, Din thought that he was dead. His stomach was still lodged somewhere up in his throat, the sensation of falling dizzy between his ears. But then Din realized that being dead probably wouldn't hurt this much, and he stifled a cry of pain with all the willpower that he could muster. He kept his eyes screwed shut. He lay very still. Din was moving. He didn't know where he was or how he'd gotten there, but he was moving, and he was in so much pain that he almost wanted to die. Wanted to slide backwards into a dream, a nightmare, because at least Din knew that he'd survived that nightmare. He had survived the Separatist attack that had destroyed his village. The Mandalorians had come, they'd saved him, they'd smeared Bacta onto his reed cuts, and the warrior who'd found Din huddled in the wreckage of his village had carried him away, hiding Din's face against his chest so that Din wouldn't have to look and see what had happened to his home, to his family. This felt worse than that nightmare, that memory. Din's right leg was on fire, his shoulder too, and his bad arm. His head hurt, his mouth tasted like blood. "I fell," Din remembered. He kept his eyes shut and tried to keep his breathing even, tried to keep it shallow. Memories came back to him in fragments, each one sharp enough to cut. The throne room destroyed, Nora's tapestry burned, the hole in the side of Boba's tower and the ceiling of the throne room, the debris scattered across the sands. The hunt, Din thought, struggling to push down the red tide of pain that was howling in his chest like a river in flood. Like a surge of dark water so great and so fierce that it cleared away everything in its path. Din remembered the hunt, following the mercenaries' trail through the Jundland wastes, the signs of fighting, Kasik. Boba's people hadn't taken their defeat lying down. Din was one of Boba's people, so I can't die, Din told himself grimly, fighting against that tide. I can't, not without fighting. Din was pretty sure that his leg was broken, that his shoulder was dislocated, and that the Trandoshan had broken two or three of Din's fingers, and the fall from the second cliff, five or six of Din's ribs. But Din couldn't lie down and die just yet. His people were alive. They were alive. Some of them had died, but not all of them, and Din needed to rescue them. He needed to find Boba. He needed to get them, all of them, out. Din let out another breath. He didn't die. Agony battered at him, roared. Din's village on his home planet had been in the mountains, but a river had run through it, and that had made the river of the mountains, too. Din knew what the river had been like in flood, unstoppable, untamable, but survivable. Din knew how to swim. He knew how to live with pain, too. He stopped trying to fight the hurt and let agony wash over him. Din let it breathe inside of him like he'd let the pain of Boba's flogger, of the reed cane, breathe. Had let those hurts become part of Din, and counted down from the highest number that he knew. The insides of his eyelids were seared with red. The pain in his leg wasn't like anything that Din had ever felt before. It wasn't like anything he'd learned to tolerate, to enjoy, underneath Boba's hands. But it did recede eventually. Din wasn't sure how long it took. He hadn't opened his eyes yet, but he was moving and the suns were warm on his face, so he knew that he wasn't lying at the bottom of a canyon in the middle of the Juntland Wastes. Someone had found him. Someone was moving him. Boba would have treated Din's injuries first, so Din knew that he wasn't with Boba. Which means, Din thought, as the tide of pain began to ebb back down to something that Din could survive, that I'm probably with an enemy. Din breathed shallowly until he could think past his pain, and then he tried to listen. He didn't open his eyes, not yet. If he was with an enemy, captured on the way to whatever fate awaited Boba's entire outfit, then Din didn't want to give away any advantage, no matter how slim, that he could get. Pain roared in his ears, but Din pushed it away. He listened harder. Other sounds broke through the roar. The rumble of an engine, one large enough to power a landspeeder or a small barge. The higher whines of swoop bikes, voices. Huddies, Din thought, focusing on the voices with some effort. Focusing on something outside of his own body helped Din drag himself out of the flood, gave him something to hold on to. Hope my grip holds this time, he thought grimly. Din had slipped on the cliffs, but here... The voices were divided into two groups. One group was shouting, commands lobbing back and forth over Din's head like blaster fire. The swoop bikes, Din thought, outriders or scouts, the Trandoshan maybe. The other group was much quieter, their voices nearly lost under the rumble of the speeder's engine, the rush of the wind. Din had to strain to hear them.
Choisi chopa chimurishani, eh? Someone said.
They spoke Huddies in a thick, muddy drawl, like a native Narshadan or Nalhadan, someone who lived in the heart of Hutt territory. Din didn't recognize the voice, and running Huddies through his head, shifting the words into basic, made pain spike hard behind Din's right eye. He gritted his teeth and hoped that no one noticed. How much is the bounty hunter worth? They're speaking behind me, Din thought. So either I'm facing the back of the speeder, or they got me chained up front. Din was chained. He could feel the chains now that he could think past his broken leg. Bands of metal had been wrapped around his wrists. More metal clinked in the wind. Tension held Din down, though not as tightly as he would have thought. They didn't use mag cuffs or binders, Din thought, and no one's chained my feet. His captors... Hutt mercs working with the Trandoshans, had either run out of chains or they'd decided that Din was too badly injured to give them any trouble. Their mistake, Din thought. Another merc snorted. Not just any regular bounty hunter either, he replied. Din focused on the Huddies. He needed information before he tried to escape, to fight. He needed to know where he was and who had him, what they planned to do with him.
How much do you think we'll get for Boba Fett's pet?
The merc laughed.
Gorga yacha,
he said. Gorga knows. Their conversation ebbed like the pain in Din's leg. Okay, Din thought, head a little clearer. I have been caught, and they're taking me to Gorga. That's not good, but it could be worse. As consciousness had returned, so had Din's awareness of himself and his surroundings. The mercs had left his feet free, but they'd done a thorough job of stripping Din of his weapons. From what he could feel with his eyes closed, all of Din's armor was more or less intact. The mercs hadn't bothered to pick him over like a pack of Urusai scavenging a corpse down to the bone. That was good. What wasn't good was the series of empty knife sheaths that Din could feel when he started to slowly, carefully, take inventory of his kit. The vibro-knife on his belt was gone. So were the Verd knives in Din's boots. Din's gauntlets were still on, the seals intact, but he was out of Whistling Birds. The hooks where his spear usually hung were empty too, and the darksaber was missing from his hip. They took all of it, Din thought. He could only hope that the mercs had brought all of Din's gear with them instead of pitching it all over the side of the cliff into the bottom of the canyon. If they'd done that, Din never would have been able to find it again. He thought about surviving this mess long enough to tell Bo-Katan Kryze that he'd lost the darksaber in a fight with some nameless Trandoshan merc on Tatooine and had to bite back a half-hysterical laugh. She'd kill me, he thought, and then she'd come here and kill all of the mercs, too. Din was oddly comforted by that thought, even though he knew that it was ridiculous. The Mandalorians had saved Din when he'd been a child, but they weren't coming now. Din had walked away from them. He pushed that grief aside, just like he shoved aside his pain. What mattered now was survival, was finding everyone else. To do that, Din thought, I need to know where I am. He didn't want the mercs to know that he was conscious again, so Din carefully slitted his eyes open, just enough that the red light behind his eyes turned white, and the white light resolved itself into the familiar bright glare of the Great Dune Sea. Din hadn't been out for that long. The suns were lower in the sky now, but they hadn't sunk behind the horizon, and the sky was still a hard, flat blue. White sand dunes whipped past. Din couldn't see the Jundlons. He could see part of the speeder he was on, though. Din had been dumped at the front of a battered sand-colored land speeder that looked like it had been cobbled together from half a dozen different models. The speeder was open to the air, letting wind rush past Din, sand stinging his face. Two swoop bikes were roaring on either side of the speeder Din had been thrown on. Din didn't want to turn his head to catch a glimpse of the speeder on the right. He could see its nose, but not its rider. But the swoop on the left was manned by a battle-scarred human man. Din didn't know him. The Trandoshan was nowhere to be seen. Neither was any of Din's gear. But if Din focused, he could feel something bumping against his left boot whenever the speeder skimmed too roughly over the sand. A crate or a bag, something heavy that clinked when it made contact with the plates of his calf. Din didn't dare try to turn his head. He wanted to play dead for as long as he could. Every minute that he wasn't unconscious gave Din more information and gave him more time to breathe, to think, to push away how badly his leg hurt, how sharply his head ached. A jumble of tall red rocks whipped past. Din's eyes widened a fraction before he caught himself and slitted them shut again. I know where I am, Din realized. One of the rocks that he just whipped past had been shaped like a sleeping Anuba. Mos Pelgo. Din stayed very still, even as his mind began to turn, thoughts whirling. Din was familiar with the terrain around Mos Pelgo. He'd been a guest in Cobb's house. He knew where the best cover was, and he knew how to get through Mos Pelgo's much smaller canyon range. Din didn't know what Gorga's mercenaries had done to Mos Pelgo, though. He didn't know if the town was still standing. But the canyons would be standing, and if Din could manage to get away, kill a merc or two, get on a speeder, he could disappear down a canyon and out into the wilder desert. Into the Sun Rocks territory, he thought. Another thought kindled in Din's chest. If these mercs were with the Trandoshan scouting in the wastes, he thought, and they're headed to Mos Pelgo, does that mean that the mercs are staging themselves out of Mos Pelgo? Is that where they've been taking us? Din didn't have to wait long to find out. From the rock shaped like a sleeping Anuba, the land speeder and its swoop-bike escort swung around, slowing down and approaching a familiar collection of white buildings crouched safely in the shadow of a banded red mesa. Even with his eyes mostly closed, Din could see that Mos Pelgo had been hit pretty hard, too. The air was heavy with smoke. The barracks building that Boba's guards, Kirsha Littlemoon and her crew, had built was destroyed. Blasted down to its foundations. Some of the little farm plots, the stands of polta beans and black melons, the shaggy pastures of Puntan grass and Jaipur, had been razed, the crops pulled and fired. Most of the houses lining Mos Pelgo's crooked main street had scorch marks or holes in their roofs. The dead had been left to swell in the suns. The town was empty. No one came out to greet the swoops or the speeder carrying Din, so he had his answer about whether or not the mercenaries had staged their attack out of Mos Pelgo. They hadn't. They had come and destroyed and taken Mos Pelgo's people, and then they had left again.
The cantina was still standing, though, and it was to the cantina that the landspeeder went, slowing to a complete stop in front of the cantina's swinging doors. Din risked opening his eyes a little to get a better look at the body strewn in the street in front of the cantina, then sagged against the chains in relief. He didn't see anyone that he knew. Not Cobb Vanth or the Weequay bartender, not Tobes the Little Bith or Old Dearman, not Kirsha Littlemoon or even any of the Sunrock scouts. So, where are they? Din wondered. He stayed where he was, trying to keep his face slack, his body limp, while the two mercs that had been wondering about how much Clinkton would fetch them hopped from the back of the speeder. Their boots crunched in the sand. "Need any help with this one?" a voice Din hadn't heard before remarked. The two swoop bikes had pulled up to the cantina beside the larger speeder, and their riders racked them down to idle. "Shouldn't, nah," said one of the mercs that had been on the land speeder with Din. The Narshadan, who spoke Basic with the same sticky drawl that he'd spoken Hatties in. "Can't imagine he'll be any trouble. Bosk said he fell a good ways, didn't he?" Bosk must have been the Trandoshan. Din tucked the name away into his memory. He'd have to find Bosk later, if Din lived, and toss Bosk off a cliff to see how much he enjoyed the experience. "You don't want to underestimate a Mandalorian," another voice warned. This one was higher, with a rasp to it, and something about the accent itched the back of Din's brain. "I know that voice," he thought, "or something like it." He tried to focus past his headache. The voice must have belonged to the bike rider Din hadn't been able to see, which meant that the one who'd asked if the speeder merc needed help was the battle-scarred human. "This is the one that took Jalto," the speaker continued. "Jassa, too, I bet."
"It was some spacer that took Jassa," the Narshadan disagreed. "No Mandalorian raided Gela's place. We'd have heard about it."
The higher voice, female Din thought, made an unimpressed noise.
"No Mandalorian in armor," she said.
A hand came down hard on Din's shoulder, and it took all of his self-control not to react, to let his body roll limply with a hand as it shook him. The jostling made the ache in his leg climb towards a red haze of agony very quickly, but Din managed not to scream. He made sure that his eyes were fully closed.
"This one's not wearing his helmet," she continued. The hand left Din.
"Bosk didn't take it, did he? Gorga's gonna want the full set for his wall."
"What, like a Rancor skin?" the Narshadan laughed.
The female speaker didn't join in. The Narshadan stopped, clearing his throat.
"I don't think so," he said. "Mando was like this when Boss dragged him over. Didn't say nothing about a helmet. We can check all the kit, but..."
"Do," said the speaker. "And then get him in some better chains before he comes to. You don't want a pissed-off Mandalorian unsecured in your grasp, Buki, even one that's mostly dead." Half dead, Din thought. He would need to make his move soon, then, but not yet. The air moved in front of his body. Boots crunched on the sand. Din cracked an eye open again and took a better look at his captors. There were four of them, two humans, one Rodian, and a female Zygerian. The Zygerian could have been Jassa's twin, except that her fur was blue. She was in Katarn-class armor, same as the other three mercs, and her back was turned to Din. "Another Zygerian," he thought. "We did miss the signs." He wondered how closely Zygeria was working with Gorga, then set the thought aside. Din could worry about that after he'd gotten out of this mess.
Yeah, said the Rodian. He'd been the one wondering about Din's price with the Narshadan, who must have been the second human man, a scrawny, underfed sort with pale hair and only one eye.
"How much are we going to get for him, do you think? Gorga's going to pay us good, right?"
"If he doesn't, I will," said the Zygerian airily. "He's worth a moon's ransom, assuming he can be trained. But you should offer him to Gorga first. We wouldn't want to offend himself." The other mercenaries chuckled like the Zygerian had told a particularly clever joke, and the one-eyed human looked back at Din. Din held very still.
"We'll bring him to you, Jekka, if the Hutt don't want him," he promised.
The Zygerian was still turning away from Din, but Din knew that she was smiling.
"Good," she said. "You too sure you don't want help bringing him in?"
The Rodian and the one-eyed man exchanged glances, then shook their heads.
"And share the bounty?" the Rodian said. "Nah, we've got him. If he wakes up and causes any trouble, we'll break the other leg. Right, Yeno?"
The one-eyed man nodded.
"Right," he said.
Jekka snorted. On your own heads, then, she said. We'll see you soon. Big show's at midnight. You don't want to miss it.
We won't, the Rodian assured her. Yeno, come on, you keep watch over the Mando while I go looking for some proper binders. I know we left some here in case we caught those carking Tuskens.
The little huddle of mercenaries broke up. Jacka and the battle-scarred human, who'd barely spoken and hadn't been named, climbed back onto their swoop bikes and sped off. The sounds of their engines echoed off Mos Pelgo's little huddle of destroyed houses, then faded. The Rodian left, ducking into the cantina. Din quickly lost sight of him in the gloom, but heard him jostling around. Broken glass crunched. The cantina probably looked like the throne room had. The human, Yeno, stayed with Din. He cast a disinterested look at Din, saw that Din was still lying limp and motionless, and looked away. Din carefully shifted his head to get a better look at his guard.
I need the keys to these cuffs, Din thought. They were tied around his wrist.
Even if Din somehow managed to wriggle his way out of his gloves, his gauntlets, Din would probably have to break a finger or two to do it, and his hand already hurt. He needed at least enough unbroken fingers to grip a blaster. Or a vibroknife, the Darksaber, anything, to cut them off. The chain between the cuffs, anchoring Din to the side of the speeder, wasn't very tight, though. There was some give in it, especially when Din, keeping one eye on Yeno, slid very, very slowly closer to the rung his chains had been wrapped through.
I've got maybe 7-8 inches of slack, Din thought.
Not enough to get off the speeder, not enough to even stand, but enough, maybe, to cause some trouble.
I need a closer look at this guard.
Yeno might have the keys that Din needed to get himself free. Din deliberated for a moment, weighing his options, and then decided to cause trouble even though he didn't know when the Rodian would emerge from the cantina. Din's situation was not likely to improve unless he made it improve. No one was coming to get him out. Din was going to have to do it himself. He was used to extracting himself from bad situations.
Playing dead, that's been useful lately, he thought.
He remembered sparring with Boba, with Ashek. Playing injured had created openings. Din could try that again.
Probably helps that I really am hurt, he thought.
Someone, the Trandoshan or either of these mercs, had fished Din out from the cliffside. They'd seen his injuries. Din made sure that his eyes were mostly closed, open just wide enough to see light, see shapes. And then he let out a thin, rattling groan. He'd heard plenty of beings die. Din knew what a death rattle sounded like. The blurry shape that was Yeno, startled, looked over at Din. Din didn't move. Din groaned again, convincingly, and affected a full-body shudder. Moving made his leg complain, a sharp pain spiking, but that only helped add some authenticity to Din's next groan of pain.
Kark, said Yeno.
He stepped closer, leaning over the side of the speeder. A shadow moved behind him, too indistinct for Din to see clearly. Yeno stopped, just shy of the speeder.
No good, Din thought. I've got the reach to grab him with the slack in the chain, but I don't know if I'm strong enough to heave him over the side of the speeder, not right now.
Din needed Yeno in the speeder. Din shuddered again, shifting his groan down to a low, almost inaudible wheeze. He rolled his eyes underneath his eyelids, darting them back and forth like he'd lost control of his body. Kark, Yeno said, leaping over the side of the speeder. It buckled under his weight, pitching Din forward, but Din managed to keep from screaming as the motion bashed his leg.
Hey, Skirpa, you'd better come here, doesn't it?
Yeno crouched over Din, reaching down to lay a clammy hand against the side of Din's neck. And it was the last mistake that Yeno made. Din was hurt and exhausted and confused. He was badly injured. But he was still Mandalorian, trained by the fiercest, fastest fighters of his covert, and Din had always been quick on the draw. He lashed out, too fast for Yeno to react, and wrapped his chained hands around either side of Yeno's throat. Din hadn't meant to let Yeno shout for the Rodian, but it was too late for that now. Din had his chance. He couldn't waste it. He opened his eyes and looked Yeno full in the face. The sunlight glared down on both of them. Yeno was middle-aged, old for a mercenary, and he was crossed with dozens of scars. His eyes were brown and bulging wide. Din's hands were weak, but Yeno had chained Din down with chains meant to hold a Mandalorian. They were strong chains. All Din had to do was keep the pressure on Yeno's throat steady, strangling him in a matter of seconds.
He dragged Yano down towards his own body while Yano tried to pull away and waited for Yano to panic. Din didn't have to wait long. Each second felt like a year, pain screaming wide at the base of Din's skull. But Yano panicked within 5-10 seconds. Instead of slamming a fist down into Din's nose and sending Din back into unconsciousness, Yano began to scrabble frantically at the chain wrapped around his throat. He kicked, his fingernail scratched Din's gloves. The chain had no give in it. Yano's face reddened, then purpled, his eyes bulging wider and wider. He gasped like a landed cola claw fish. Din didn't need him dead, just unconscious, but he kept the pressure up on the chain even after Yano went slack and lolled against Din bonelessly. Din had caught Yano by playing dead. He had no intention of letting Yano catch him a second time the same way. When Din was sure that Yano wouldn't move again, he finally let up with the chain and shoved Yano off of him. Yano didn't move. The whole thing had taken maybe 20 seconds, but Din could hear the Rodian calling back now.
"Hey, Yano,"
the Rodian shouted.
"Did you shout for me? What's wrong?"
Din had very little time. From this angle, he couldn't really see what Yano had been carrying, but the merc had to be armed with at least a blaster. He groped blindly at Yano's belt, and his hand closed around a worn grip. Finally. Din pulled the blaster free, fired it in the direction of the cantina, and sat up, fighting through a wave of darkness and nausea that immediately tried to get him to lay back down. He didn't have enough slack in the chain to sit all the way up, but he had enough to see past the nose of the speeder, past Yano's body. Din hadn't hit the Rodian. The Rodian had good reflexes. He saw the blaster go off and ducked, throwing himself to the ground. Din didn't have a good angle on him from here. Din couldn't shoot him. Din fired again anyway, more to give himself a few seconds of cover than anything else, and turned his next shot onto the chain that had been looped through a rung bolted into the side of the speeder. The chain glowed red hot, the bolt fired too close to it to ricochet away, and gave when Din fired again. More free to move, Din sat all the way up and took aim at the Rodian, who rolled out of the way and dove for cover behind an overturned table inside the cantina. Din's hands were still chained together, but Din had more room to maneuver. He could aim. Din bared his teeth. "If you surrender," Din called, his voice cracked and hoarse from screaming, "I won't kill you."
"Echuta!"
the Rodian spat. A darker shape was moving in the back of the cantina behind him. "I have to stand," Din thought. "I have to get in there. If I sit here and he sits there, this will never end." Keeping his blaster trained on the space where the Rodian had disappeared, Din eased himself carefully to the edge of the speeder. He needed the rest of his gear, too, but that could wait until the Rodian was dead. Din put his left leg, which ached dully, having taken some of the impact of Din's fall, too, but held his weight, down into the sand. A blue antenna waved from behind the table. Din shot it. The Rodian howled. "All right," Din thought, testing his left leg. "I can do this. I have to do this." He slid his broken leg off the speeder and set it on the sand, then shifted, determined to stand. That was a mistake. The agony that rocketed through Din brought him to his knees. He screamed behind his teeth, clenching his mouth shut to avoid giving the Rodian the satisfaction of hearing Din yell, and tried to shift his weight over to his left knee. He couldn't see, he couldn't speak, he couldn't even shoot. Din tried to make his fingers pull the trigger to fire another warning shot to buy Din some more time to recover, but his entire body had frozen in pain, muscle straining. He could barely hear anything over the rush in his ears. The pain took several precious seconds to pass. Din felt each one hooked underneath his skin. By the time the pain had faded enough for Din to carking think, he knew that he'd lost any advantage that he'd won by strangling Yano. The Rodian had realized it, too. While Din had been blind and deaf from pain, the Rodian had ducked out of cover again, short an antenna, and aimed a blaster at Din. There were only 15 feet between them. The Rodian would have to be dead to miss a shot at that distance. The dark muzzle of his blaster was aimed at Din's forehead. "How about," the Rodian said, "you surrender and I won't kill you." Din showed the Rodian all of his teeth. "Why?" Din panted, stalling for time. "So you can sell me to the highest bidder?" The Rodian shrugged. "Better alive as a slave than dead in the desert," the Rodian said. He looked Din up and down, then smiled meanly. "Not that you'd fetch a high price in your condition. What happened to you, huh?
I thought Mandalorians were supposed to be the best fighters in the galaxy. You look like you couldn't win a fight against a Loth kitten.
You fall off a cliff and see how you look, Din thought, but didn't say.
It would come down to a matter of speed. Who could pull the trigger faster? If Din could get a shot off before the Rodian could. He hadn't dropped Yeno's blaster.
I can do it, Din thought, but I have to time it right.
Why don't you put your blaster down and come over here and find out, Din suggested. I'll throw mine away too. We'll do this hand to hand. If you beat me, you can have my Beskar. Naked greed flickered across the Rodian's face.
Your Beskar?
Din shrugged. The motion made him want to scream, but he bit that sound back too.
Sure,
Din said. His voice was ragged with pain. He could hear it.
I'm not going to need it dead, am I?
You might if Gorga wants to sell you to the fighting pits, the Rodian returned. But he was tempted. Din could see it. He just needed an opening.
Don't have any use for your chest plate, the Rodian said, more to himself than to Din. Too big, but the pauldron, that's nice. I could...
He never finished. Din had set his finger on the blaster's trigger, ready to pull, but he didn't get to finish the argument with the Rodian either. The Rodian jerked, mouth falling slack in surprise, and then toppled over dead, his blaster falling from nerveless fingers. A Verd knife sprouted from his back.
What? Din thought, confused. All of his knives were in a heap somewhere, hopefully on the landspeeder, but Din hadn't had time to look for them yet. He didn't know where a proper Mandalorian Verd knife had come from.
Fennec Shand stepped out of the shadows of the cantina and came to stand over the Rodian's body, looking Din up and down.
There you are, she said. I was wondering when you'd turn up.
Din stared at her. He didn't understand.
She looked like she'd had a very bad day.
Din had seen Fennec injured a time or two. She'd been grazed by a slug thrower once, back at the beginning of all of this, and had been blown up with Din during the first raid on the palace. But he'd never seen her look so battered before. Her hair had come loose from its customary braid and hung wild and dusty all around her shoulders. Her coat was torn, and there was a burn creasing her forehead. Her face was mottled black and blue, and both of her lips were cracked, the cuts just barely scabbed over. Her nose had been broken, and one cheek was swollen. Someone had given her a beating. But she was alive, standing, and she was in front of Din. She was alive. Din didn't think he'd ever been so glad to see her before.
Hey, he said weakly. It's good to see you too, Shand.
Still on his knees, Din swayed dangerously, listing to the left. Fennec saw and rushed over to him immediately, catching Din by the shoulders, propping him up. Din hissed in pain, but let Fennec manhandle him over to the side of the cantina, where she pushed him so that he was sitting down and helped him straighten out his leg. She knew what the problem was immediately.
Hold on for a second, Fennec said. Kark, Din, I'll be right back, then we'll see about your leg.
A second, Din, she said, leaving no room for Din to argue, and then she left. She picked up the Rodian's fallen blaster and checked it, then shot the Rodian in the back of the head. She did the same to Yeno. Din thought about protesting, telling Fennec that he needed one of them alive to tell him where the mercenaries were gathering, where they'd taken Boba, but hoped that Fennec had a better idea. She'd come from inside the cantina, but Din was pretty sure that she was the shadow he'd seen behind Yeno, behind the Rodian. She'd seen that Din was in trouble and had come to help him.
She's hurt, but she's here, Din thought, so she got away too. She might know more about where Boba is than me.
Fennec checked both bodies over, fished the knife out of the Rodian's back, then kicked the Rodian in disgust. She hopped into the landspeeder. There was a great clattering and clamoring, and then Fennec popped back over the side, Din's spear and Boba's Gaderfi in one hand each. Din sagged back against the wall in relief. The Trandoshan hadn't left Din's gear in the desert then. He had loaded it up with Din. He'd even gone down into the canyon to search Din's speeder. Din had left Boba's Gaderfi strapped to the Zephyr G because he'd planned to come back down once he'd picked up a trail to follow. Fennec tossed both weapons down into the sand beside Din and went back for a black bag. She threw the bag down beside him too, then rejoined him.
Found your stuff, she said. Which is good, because I'm out of knives.
What's mine is yours, Din wheezed.
He leaned back against the cantina and studied Fennec. Relief blazed behind his ribs, almost bright enough to drown out the pain in his leg, his chest.
What about the knife you just had?
Fennec had tucked the Verd knife back into an oversized holster at her hip.
It's not mine, she said.
Fennec fished a canteen of water out from the bag and offered it to Din, who drank a little to get the taste of blood out of his mouth. Then she leaned over to the Rodian, tore a strip of fabric off the Rodian's shirt, and soaked it with the canteen. Din raised an eyebrow, confused.
I borrowed it, she said, and you look terrible.
She dabbed the side of Din's face with a rag, and Din saw the fabric come away with rust red. He frowned. He hadn't even realized that he'd been bleeding. But he'd bled on Kronos, too, and the wound must have reopened when Din had fallen off the plateau. Now that he thought about it, his cheek was tender and hot, too, swollen where the armorer had hit him. Din's face probably didn't look much better than Fennec's.
Probably why the mercs underestimated me, Din mumbled.
Talking still hurt. He flicked his gaze over Fennec.
You look terrible too, you know.
Thanks, Jaren, she said. She wiped some of the blood off the side of Din's face and took a better look at his head.
I don't think you're gonna die, though.
That's good.
It is, Fennec agreed. Here, take this.
She put a pill, chalky and bitter, against Din's mouth. He obeyed her, letting her pop the pill into his mouth and swallowing it down. It was bitter on his tongue, too.
What was that?
Simoxin, said Fennec. I'm gonna set your leg.
You're...
A more patient person, or a person who'd had formal medical training, would have waited for the Simoxin to fully take effect before grabbing their patient's broken leg and shoving it back into the right alignment. Fennec could be plenty patient, but Din doubted that she'd ever had any formal medical training. She didn't wait. Din swallowed the pill, and Fennec set her hand on either side of Din's right leg, just below the knee, and wrenched hard. Fennec was surprisingly strong. Din shouted. Blackness danced around the edges of his vision. He didn't pass out, though, which was an improvement on the rest of Din's day so far, and Fennec let him go as soon as she was done.
We don't have time to do more than stick you with some Bacta and splint it, she warned. If we survive this, Jaren, you're gonna want to go visit your friend the Medroid.
Din groaned. Groaning was better than shouting. He was sure that in a few days he would appreciate Fennec's foresight. Better to set a break now, a few hours after the injury, than wait a few days and have to re-break the leg. But Din had managed to get his pain under control, more or less, and now Fennec had brought it all roaring back. The hit of Simoxin started working after a few minutes of shallow breathing, though. The pain began to ease again. Fennec let Din work through it, returning with a Bacta injection, which she gave Din just below the knee, and another tab of something that was just as chalky and bitter as the Simoxin, but yellow instead of white.
Antiseptin, she said when Din looked at her, so you don't start to rot.
Din grimaced. He took that pill, too. Fennec helped him splint his leg. The break wasn't as bad as Din had feared. He'd broken one of the bones in his lower leg, not his femur like Paz had. Assuming they'd survived all of this and made it to a Medroid, Din's leg would probably heal. Fennec scavenged some scrap metal from the debris around the cantina and used two panels to brace Din's lower leg, tying them off with more strips from the dead Rodian shirt.
I'm gonna be hobbling around just like he is, Din thought.
Thinking of Paz and his limp almost made Din smile.
We're gonna match, he thought.
He knew that he was too old to heal from a broken leg very cleanly, no matter how much Bacta Fennec gave him.
Take a minute, Fennec advised. We're gonna have to hobble a little ways, then you can get off your feet.
Din closed his eyes and blew out a breath.
Great, he muttered.
Fennec chuckled, and there was an edge to it that Din had never heard in her voice before.
No, he thought, that's not right. I have heard her sound like that before, under Gela's place, when she thought I'd been killed.
Even though his leg hurt, even though he wanted to throw up or pass out or both, Din couldn't help but soften. Fennec had been worried about him.
I'll be all right, Din said gruffly, but a minute would be good.
Fennec inclined her head.
You've got it, she promised. Gorgas Mercs have cleared out of here, more or less. We shouldn't see anyone around here until someone notices that those two Kirkwits didn't report in.
They've cleared out. They're not camping around here somewhere. Fennec nodded. Not as far as I could tell, anyway, she said. They've broken off into teams, 20 or 30 each. They're probably sweeping the sands now, trying to round up the rest of the Tuscans, but they've already been through Muspelgo. I think they got just about everybody. Din thought of Cobb, of his little town, and winced.
Where... what happened? He asked.
Fennec grimaced.
You went by the palace?
Din nodded.
So you can guess, she said.
We were... I don't know. I don't know what we missed, Jaren. One minute, everything was fine. Boss got back, said that you were on your way. We decided to hold court since he'd been gone for a few days. Remind everyone who was king, show everyone that everything was fine, then...
She broke off, shook her head.
Din understood.
We would have fought to the death, Fennec said quietly. Boba and I, but the Mercs, they knew all of our soft spots. Boba went on a rampage, must have killed Tan on his own, and I was right behind him, but then the Mercs dragged Ushib and Geeta out. They'd been down to the kitchens.
Din closed his eyes.
Told us all to stand down or they'd kill Ushib and Geeta, Fennec continued.
It would have worked, too, I think, except Ushib's always had one more knife than anyone ever expects to have, and Geeta kicked the Merc who'd grabbed her in the knee, and, well, Fennec said, grimacing again.
Around that time, I took the butt of a fire puncher to the back of the head, so I don't actually remember what happened after that.
Din hardly knew what to say first. 100 thoughts swarmed through the middle of his mind. He settled on the most immediate concern.
Boba?
Fennec shook her head.
Alive, she said, or he was when we were taken from the palace.
I don't know, the Mercs split us up, kept us all in separate speeders. I think he was still alive when we were in the canyons, but Boba's speeder went one way and mine another.
Was there anyone with you in your speeder? Din asked, trying to stifle the worry that had flared when Fennec had shaken her head.
Boba was alive. He had to be.
Fennec shook her head again.
Kasik was, she said, but if you followed us through the canyons, you know what happened there.
Din flattened his mouth.
I know, he said.
Fennec sighed.
After Kasik rushed them, the Mercs decided that we were too dangerous to keep all in one place, she explained. They decided to separate us before, well... before whatever it is that they have planned happened. I was carted off east. They were gonna offer me to some pike thugs.
Din winced. He didn't like pikes.
But you got away.
The smile Fennec gave Din was cold and sharp.
I did, she said. Din didn't have to ask what had happened to the mercenaries. He imagined that they were dead in the desert somewhere, feeding Urusai and Kirik flies.
Fennec nudged Din in the shoulder gently.
He hissed, which made her raise her eyebrows and do a more thorough inspection.
Your shoulder's dislocated, she said. What happened to you? How'd you get caught?
Din let her check the joint, which prickled hot and swollen under her hands, even through Din's kuta and his armor.
I made it to the palace, but I was too late, Din told her.
I picked up the speeder trail, followed it through the canyons. I found Kasik, I found where the caravan split up. I didn't know which trail Boba had been taken down, so I went up the side of the canyon to see if some height helped.
Ah, said Fennec, illustratively.
Din scowled at her.
I didn't fall on purpose, he snapped.
She left his shoulder and started poking and prodding Din for more injuries. He managed not to growl when she touched the side of his head again, examining the bruise on his face, but hissed again when she found his tender side.
I ran into a scout, Din said.
A Trandoshan. He shot me with a pulse rifle.
If we run into him again, he's mine. I'd like to pay him back for this.
And you fell 30 feet?
Breathe out.
You're lucky you're not dead, Jaren.
She said Jaren the same way she'd said, you idiot, underneath Gela's place when she'd found him and Quinlan Vos trying to recover after getting half blown up.
25, Din said defensively. He exhaled, wincing as he did. Fennec took her hands off of his side and nodded.
And I'm too stubborn to die.
Fennec huffed.
The next thing I knew, I was waking up in cuffs on a speeder, Din said. There were 4 Mercs. They brought me here.
Was one of them a Zygerian?
Din nodded.
Jekka, he said.
Fennec grunted.
She looked Din up and down critically, then said, She seems to be pretty high up. She was in the throne room, too, and she's the one who decided that all the speeders should split up. Zagiria is tangled up in all of this somehow. First Jalto, then Jasha, now the Skugsucker. I don't think your ribs are broken, by the way. Can't know for sure until we can get you scanned by a medroid, but I think they're just bruised. The Bacta should help. She was in charge here, too, Din said. He decided not to mention the fingers that he was pretty sure the Trandoshan had broken. The Cymoxin had taken the edge off Din's pain in both of his hands, and he didn't want Fennec to splint his entire hand. Din needed to be able to shoot with it. She told the others not to underestimate me. Who is she? Fennec leaned back and frowned. I don't know, she said. From the bite in her tone, Din could tell that not knowing bothered Fennec. She looked like Jasha, though. I thought so, too, Din muttered. He sorted through this conversation in his head, then circled back to something that Fennec had said earlier. About the raiders dragging Ushib and Gita up from the kitchens, trying to use them to force everyone else to surrender. Fennec, he said. The spy, it was Gita, the Ahra, it... Gorga cracked the network, he... I know, Fennec said gently. Din blinked. The idiots who were taking me to the pikes let it spill, she said. I didn't even have to start breaking bones. They were proud of it, proud that they managed to get spies into our outfit, into Vance. Fennec didn't look particularly angry, but Din knew her pretty well by now. Bulba's temper was explosive, fiery, but Fennec was like Din. Her anger was cold and slow-moving, but Din knew that her anger was deep, closely held and closely guarded. He could see a shard of it in Fennec's dark eyes. An echo in Din's chest answered Fennec, his own fury close enough to reach for, to touch. But Din fought it down. Gorga had her little brother, he said. Fennec's mouth flattened too, mirroring Din's sour expression. You don't have to defend her, she said. I do, Din disagreed. He met Fennec's eyes and then looked away again, afraid of what would happen if both of them got too angry to think. If I'd been her age and someone had taken my brother, told me that they'd hurt him unless I did what they wanted me to. You would have fought, Fennec interrupted. Din looked back at her, startled. She lifted an eyebrow. You would have fought, she repeated. You would have done something so carking stupid and so carking brave that the idiots who'd grabbed your brother wouldn't have seen it coming, and then you would have gotten your brother out. You would have done what you're doing now, Fennec said. Some of her ferocity faded. Charged off into the desert on your own without a plan, like a loth wolf with a scent in your nose. I had a plan, Din said, defensive again. Fennec smiled. Was it find the mercs and shoot them? She asked. Din scowled. Fennec's laugh, rusty and tired but genuine, caught Din by surprise. You're one of a kind, Jaren, she said. What you'd do isn't what Gita would do. Well, I'm not the boss. When we get Boba back, he can decide what to do. That's why he's in charge. She'd said when they got Boba back, not if. So even though that wasn't a guarantee that Fennec wouldn't go after Gita, it was a reassurance that they would find Boba. Din couldn't argue with that. He leaned back against the cantina. You said, did the mercs take her too, her and Ushib? They took everyone, said Fennec. I'm gonna guess that after I passed out, the mercs got a hold of someone again and pulled the same trick, threatening to kill them unless Boba surrendered. Something like that must have happened. The number of mercs surprised us, but we were fighting. We were making progress. But when I came to, I was on the back of a speeder in the middle of the Jundland Wastes. When we stopped, I did a head count. The mercs were pretty thorough. They rounded up all of us at the palace, and most of Mos Pelgo, too. Your friend Vanth is alive, Fennec added when she saw Din's face pale. They had him gagged, and he looked angrier than an Ackle, but he was alive. Din took another careful breath. Good, he said. Is everyone else okay? I saw that Tava had been killed in the palace, A2, to some Tuskens, anyone else? You had all of the guards, Boba, wear a tracker. Can you track them? Do they still work? Fennec shook her head. I don't think anyone else has died, she said. Ushib's got a broken arm, I think. The mercs were not very pleased that she knifed two of them. And Theron was in bad shape. Boba, too. He was unconscious the whole time. Don't know if that's because he took an especially nasty hit or if the mercs were drugging him. And you saw what happened to Kasik.
Nora? Din asked.
Fennec's expression darkened. She was all right when I saw her, said Fennec. Like I said, the mercs split us all up. Us dangerous prisoners, we were spread out across several speeders. The less dangerous ones were all grouped together. Merc's plan is to sell us all, I think, recoup some of the credits Gorga spent hiring his army. Din nodded. That's what he had thought too, but it was good to have his suspicions confirmed.
And the trackers?
Fennec shook her head again. They knew about those, she said. Someone must have talked. I didn't see the mercs take them away from everyone, but when I came to, mine was gone, and when I checked my pad, everyone else's had been deactivated, too.
Kark,
Din said feelingly.
Kark, Fennec agreed.
Din sighed and studied the sky for a minute. They had Nora sorted with the non-dangerous prisoners? He asked, trying to lighten the grim mood that had come between him and Fennec. It was too late to change what had happened at the palace.
I saw what she did. She brought out those huge blasters she keeps under the bar. She's plenty dangerous.
That won him another faint smile.
She is, Fennec allowed.
But not in the same way that you or I are.
We're gonna get them back, Jaren. No use worrying about what's already happened. You ready to move yet?
Din blinked and turned his attention to his various aches and pains. Fennec's Zymoxin had done its job. Din's legs still hurt, but it was more manageable now. He could think around the pain. His ribs felt better, too, and even the pain in his bad arm had faded. His shoulder still throbbed hotly and his head hurt, but Din thought that he could probably stand. Probably walk if he had to.
Din nodded.
I'm ready, he said.
Good, said Fennec. She stood and stretched, her shoulders popping. Then she offered a hand down to Din, who took it.
Fennec heaved Din up to his feet. He put all his weight on his left leg first, then slowly shifted some over to his right leg to make sure that he could stand. He had to bite the inside of his cheek fiercely to keep from shouting, but his leg held.
We don't have to go far, Fennec assured him, seeing his mouth tighten in pain. Then we can get you some of the good stuff, okay?
Lean against the wall. Din inclined his head in one sharp, short nod, then did as Fennec said. While he leaned there, panting from the simple effort of standing up, Fennec bent and scooped up Din's gear. She helped Din hook his spear on his back and handed off all of his knives, letting Din slot them into their places on his own. When she gave him the darksaber, Din couldn't help but clutch at it a little bit, relieved to be holding it again. Fennec kept Boba's Gaderfi. Being fully kitted up helped Din find some balance. He still wanted his helmet, but knew he'd be fine without it. He pushed himself up off the wall and focused on putting one foot in front of the other. Fennec leaned against him. Walking through Mos Pelgo like this wasn't anything at all like taking a flogging. That pain had built and built, one blow on top of the other. Walking on a broken leg was a gnawing pain, the kind of hurt that chewed on the base of Din's spine that sapped his strength. But Fennec lent Din her shoulder, hooking an arm wordlessly around Din's waist, and together they managed to start off down the street.
"Where are we going?" Din asked between deep, deliberate breaths.
"Not far," Fennec promised. "Just into the canyon." Din grunted and looked down the street. Mos Pelgo had always seemed very small to Din, especially compared to some of the other settlements on Tatooine, like Mos Eisley or Mos Entha. The town was really just a collection of houses all banded together for protection, for safety. And the sight of them, scored and scorched by blaster fire, made Din think of his dream, the red lights in the sky. He swallowed, and his mouth tasted like bile.
"What's in the canyon?" he asked.
Mos Pelgo felt much bigger now that Din had to walk through it on a broken leg, but Fennec was steady at his side.
Fennec smiled.
"You'll see," she said.
That was not particularly encouraging, Din grunted.
"Do you think that anyone else escaped?" Din asked. "Nora, Geeta, Ushib?"
That question took the smile off Fennec's face.
"I don't know," she said. "Ushib's a fighter, Nora too, but I don't know which direction they were taken in."
Din winced. That wasn't good.
Do you think the mercs will bring everyone back together? Fennec thought for a moment, still supporting Din's weight, and then she nodded slowly. I think so, she said. I don't know what Gorga's final plan is, but the mercs took Boba somewhere. They're not going to try to sell him down the Sour Lanes. He's too dangerous. But the Zygerian woman, Jekka, I heard her talking to some of the others. Gorga's coming here to Tatooine. I think they're going to take everyone there. Gorga's coming here, Din said. Fennec nodded again. He's a Hutt, she said. He'll want a spectacle. Din swallowed. The burn of bile returned, stronger than before. A spectacle of what? He asked, though he thought that he already knew the answer. Fennec snorted. Boba's execution, of course, she said. The anger that spiked through Din's belly at her words was almost as strong a painkiller as Fennec's Zymoxin. He started to limp faster. Gorga's hardly gonna leave him alive, Fennec continued. Boba's too much of a threat. He's got too much power on Tatooine now, and he's been making a fool of Gorga for months. Execution. A spectacle. We're going to stop him, Din said. It wasn't a question. We are, Fennec agreed. Jekka said that they're gathering at midnight. We still have some time left. We just need to figure out where they're meeting. How are we gonna do that? Din asked. Fennec's arm tightened around his waist. You'll see, she said again, which didn't answer Din's question, but he was relieved that she had some kind of plan. Din could probably help her, could contribute what he'd learned following the mercenary caravan in the desert, but for now he focused on putting one foot in front of the other, looking resolutely at the rocks ahead to avoid looking at the destruction that had visited Mos Pelgo. The cliffs that protected Mos Pelgo were smaller than the great towering mesas and plateaus of the Jundland Wastes, but Din had walked these canyons with Cobb Vanth, and he knew them well enough. We're not about to get ambushed, are we? He asked, thinking of the Trandoshan. Din hadn't seen what had happened to him, where he'd gone after he'd knocked Din off the top of the cliff. No, Fennec promised. It's safe here. Why? Din asked as he and Fennec hobbled around a bend in the canyon. Then he stopped and stared. Because, said Fennec, tone smug. When these Skugsuckers came to Mos Pelgo, they captured some of the Sunrock too, but not all of them. No, Din murmured, staring at four Banthas that had crowded into the canyon together, three ridden by Tusken warriors and the fourth topped by a familiar tall shape in battered black Beskar. Not all of them. Hey, Darvod, called Jag from his perch on top one of the shaggy Banthas. If he was bothered by the sight of Din's bare face or by Din's miserable condition, he didn't show it. They both had more important things to worry about, after all. Din smiled at him and let Fennec haul him, still limping, over to the Tuskens, to Jag. He was here, Din thought. The rest of us were on Cronest, but Jag stayed here. Jag had wanted to go hunting with the Sunrock's young warriors. He hadn't been on Cronest when the violence had erupted, when the challenges had begun, and he hadn't been in Mos Pelgo when the mercenaries had attacked. Hey, Jag, Din said. He knew where Fennec had gotten her borrowed Verd knife now. You all right? Jag nodded. We're okay, he confirmed. The Hutune weren't even looking for us. He sounded almost disappointed by that, like he'd been looking forward to punching a few Hutt mercs in the face and was irritated he'd missed out on his chance. Affection, relief, bloomed behind Din's ribs. Jag was all right. Din hadn't even thought about him, really. Din had been worried for Mos Pelgo and the Sunrock, but in his head all of the Mandalorians were still on Cronest, too far to help. But Jag was here, had been here. His armor was even more scuffed than it had been the last time Din had seen it, more silver than black or blue, and Jag sat atop his bantha with the ease of a Tusken warrior. The three Tuskens, Jag's friends, watched carefully from their own mounts. Din sagged against Fennec. Jag, realizing that Din was hurt, slid off his bantha with practiced ease, his boots kicking up sand, and strode over, hooking an arm underneath Din's shoulders. Din hissed when Jag's hand jostled his injured shoulder, but Jag was gentle enough for a Mandalorian of his size. His shoulder's dislocated, Fennec said, letting Din go. Know how to set one? Sure, said Jag, with all the confidence of a veteran of the Fighting Corps training program. You want to do that now, Darvod? Din didn't particularly, but it was a good idea to have a shoulder set before the Cymoxin wore off, so he sighed and said, "Might as well." "I found these four skulking around Muspelgo about an hour ago," Fennec said, drawing Din's attention back to her. He was grateful. Shag propped Din up against the side of his bantha, which was warm and comforting, despite the bantha's smell, and encouraged him to stand up straight. Din had had his shoulder set before, he didn't argue. One of the Tuskins began to move his hands. Din knew this Tuscan. His name was Duan, and he had been one of Miss Pelgo's guards for months now, for as long as Boba had partnered with the town. The other two must have been Jag's other friends, Aten, whom Din had met before, and Basa. "We were hunting Crate," Duan said, his hands moving fast. "We planned to be gone for many days, but then we saw the smoke in the sky and returned. We were not fast enough." "Neither was I," Din told Duan, aiming to reassure the younger warrior. He knew the guilt of coming home to find one's family killed, everyone dead, the smoke rising up to the sky. Din's dream itched at the back of his mind. He ignored it. "Then Fennec found us," Duan said. His name sign for Fennec was the same as Ushib's, which made Din smile, even as Jag stretched Din's arm out to its full extent and began lining the joint of Din's shoulder back up with the socket. It hurt tremendously, even through the gauzy haze of Cymoxin. "She brought us here. We're waiting to see if any of the Goivra would come back."
"So how are we, Kark, gonna find this meeting place of Gorgas?"
Din asked, tears springing to his eyes as Jag got Din's arm lined upright. He deliberately didn't look at Jag, waiting tense for the other Mandalorian to snap Din's shoulder back into the right spot. Duan looked at Fennec, who offered Din another knife-sharp smile. "The Mercs hit Muspelgo first," she said. "Then they came to the palace. They killed a bunch of Shaking Mountain and Sunrock Outriders on the way."
"I know," said Din. "I saw."
"But they didn't," said Fennec, flicking her eyes over at Jag, which was the only warning Din got before Jag braced Din with one arm and shoved with the other, pushing Din's shoulder back into place. Din swore. Jag didn't let up. One of the Tuskins made a sympathetic noise. "They didn't go for the spotted Anuba," Fennec finished, once Din stopped swearing. Jag let Din go, and Din immediately tucked his arm against his chest. The pain flared, hot and bright, but Din knew from experience that the worst of it was over. Jag returned to his bantha, rummaging around in its bags for something to use as a sling. Din let his ears stop ringing, then blinked at Fennec. "Gorga's mercs didn't go for the spotted Anuba." She shook her head. "No," she said. "Ashek and his tribe were too far southeast. I'm sure Gorga would have had them attacked if they'd been closer, but they were well away. Ashek saw the smoke from the palace, much like Duan here saw the smoke from Muspelgo." "But Ashek doesn't ride a bantha," said Din, realizing what had happened. "The spotted Anuba have speeders." "Like Goivra," one of the Sunrock Tuskins complained, but everyone else ignored him. Fennec grinned. "They have speeders," she agreed. "They must have been on our trail within an hour or two. Ashek picked me up in the desert after I managed to get myself free." "How did you manage to get yourself free?" Din asked. He'd assumed that she'd done what Din had, which was play dead and then lean into the element of surprise. Fennec held up her left hand, and Din got a good look at it for the first time since Fennec had grabbed him in Muspelgo. Her right hand was normal, wrapped in its usual black glove, but her left hand was swollen, the skin around her thumb blue and purple, the joint crooked. "Broke my hand," Fennec said, dry as the desert. "That's why I only gave you one tab of Cymoxin instead of two. We have to share, I'm afraid." "She wrecked a speeder, too, to hear Ashek tell it," Duan put in. He and the other two Tuskins had stayed atop their bantha mounts, but he leaned down so that Din could see his hands. "He found her walking in the desert and brought her here." Fennec ignored Duan with her usual studied grace. "Ashek and his have gone scouting for me," Fennec said, circling back to Din's question. "They peeled off after Yor Zygerian and her lackey. With any luck, she'll go straight for this place Gorga's arranged for his little show, and we can follow." "How are we gonna follow?" Din asked. "I don't see any speeders here." Fennec looked at Din, eyebrows raised. "Some of us," she said, "carry comlinks that work, Jaren." Din winced. He probably deserved that. There was, Fennec told him after she'd given Dan a few seconds to let her scathing commentary about his broken calm sink in. Not much the six of them could do now, except wait for Ashek and his scouts to return. The suns were starting to slant down towards the western horizon, but there were still 8 or 9 hours until midnight. The Sunrock Raiders took that time to water their bantha, to polish their weapons, and to get ready. Din had already tended to most of his gear on his flight over from Yavin 4, so he split another tab of Thymoxin with Fennec and leaned back against Shag's bantha to rest, careful not to jostle his bad leg. Fennec gave him another Bacta injection there, too, just below Din's knee, and one in his shoulder. Din preferred Bacta gel if he had to have Bacta at all, since the gel only felt cold and numbing, while having Bacta inside his body was numbing but oddly heavy. But Fennec didn't have any patches, and Din needed to be able to fight when Ashek came back. The Bacta that Fennec had given Din was helping. As the day wore on, Din felt it working, felt the swelling around his damaged joints ease, the sharp pain of a fresh break dulling to the prickling ache of healing bone. Jag helped Din pin his arm up in a sling, and the Suboxone did its work, dulling the pain in Din's various injuries while the sun slid lower and lower. The Tuskins passed a canteen and a few black melons around. Din was too sore to eat, but he took the water. He tried not to be nervous. Gorga's gonna execute Boba, he kept thinking. He's gonna make it a carking party. But Din had traveled with Ashek before. Ashek knew his business. He'd find Boba, and then Din could go and get him, broken leg or not. And put a blaster bolt between that Zygerian's eyes, maybe, Din thought. Gorga, too, if I can manage it. Or I can try my best to cut him in half. The Darksaber was a reassuring weight at Din's side. Din wouldn't mind killing Gorga with it. That felt right. More right than turning the Darksaber against the Allord had, than using it to frighten or hurt his own people had. Once he'd made sure that Din's shoulder was more or less all right, Jag flopped down in the sand next to Din, using his bantha for shade, and turned to look at him. His helmet, once painted black and lined with blue, was more gray and silver now. Jag had fallen a time or two out in the desert. His helmet was scuffed, much of the paint abraded away. A set of 3 vicious-looking claw marks had been scored down one of Jag's pauldrons, and Jag's kuta was torn there, too. A crate dragon, Din wondered. Duan had said that they'd all gone crate hunting, a common pastime among young warriors looking to prove themselves. Crate pearls were more valuable than credits among the Tuskens. A warrior who had 4 or 5 pearls to his name usually had his pick of wives, as pearls were a treasured gift to a spouse or a parent or a child. Jag didn't have any crate pearls on him that Din could see, but that didn't mean that the hunt had been unsuccessful. "So, Darfod," said Jag after a while, "how was that thing on Krenast?" Not for the first time, Jag's candor made Din smile. "You probably would have liked it," Din said honestly. There were a lot of Mandalorians there. More than I ever thought I'd see in one place. Were they like us? Shag asked. There was something hesitant in his tone. Din settled himself more comfortably against the side of Shag's bantha and thought about how to answer. There had been plenty of Mandalorians at the summit who'd reminded Din of Shag. Kip Awad, for one, bluff and cheerful and eager to throw himself into the tangle of flailing limbs and elbows that had constituted a get-shook game. Torg Saxon, eager to prove himself. Ciri Ordo, who had left the shelter of her clan to see the galaxy, and even Mandalorians like Akin Anson or Reardon Hokan, who'd been brave enough to speak out against something or someone they didn't believe. But that wasn't what Shag was asking. He was asking after his own people, the Children of the Watch. Din answered Shag honestly anyway. "There were a lot of Mandalorians like us," he said. "And some Children of the Watch, too. That's our people, your people, I guess. I'm officially disowned." Din thought of the Allure sinking down into the darkness below the lake, about her standing over Din, ready to kill him. The memory of her voice hurt more than Din's bruised ribs. Jag shifted. "What does that mean?" he asked. Din shrugged. It meant very little, honestly, in the face of more pressing concerns, like rescuing everyone who'd been taken, getting Boba back, and cutting Gorga the Hutt in half with a Darksaber. "It means that things are going to be different for me now," said Din. He could hear Jag frowning. "Different how?" the kid asked.
Are you Mandalorian or not? Din tilted his head back and looked up at the sky. The hard blue of midday was softening. Evening would rise soon. I am Mandalorian, Din said. Just not the kind of Mandalorian that I thought I was, that's all. So you're not Darvod anymore? Din chuckled and shrugged with his better shoulder. I'm Din, he said, but you can call me what you want, Shag. I'm still Mandalorian, but I just chose a different creed. Shag was silent for a minute, then he said, half scathing, half surprised, you can do that? Din kept looking up at the sky. He was aware of Shag watching him, of Fennec watching him. Yes, said Din, you can. Shag was quiet for a long time. Long enough for the Cymoxin to settle in, soothing Din's various hurts into a quieter background hum. He hoped that Ashek would be back soon. Din wanted to go find Boba. But what if someone else tells me that I can't? Shag asked. And he sounded young and frightened, like Din had turned his galaxy upside down and was shaking it to see what would fall out. Oh, Din thought. He should have guessed. Shag was riding a bantha. His Tusken friends had invited him crate hunting, which had been a rite of passage for young Tuskens for as long as the suns had risen over the sands. He wants to know if he can be both, Din thought. If he can be Mandalorian and Tusken, if that would break the creed. Tell them to kark off, Din said honestly. Your creed, it's yours, it's not anyone else's. No one else can decide for you if you're Mandalorian or not. But nothing, said Din. He curled his left hand around the hilt of the darksaber. He was glad that he hadn't lost it in the desert. I'm the Mandalore. You can be whoever you want to be, Shag, and if anyone tells you otherwise, they can answer to me. The Mandalore? Fennec said, breaking into the conversation. Probably for the best, Din thought. Shag had fallen into a shocked silence, and Din didn't know what he was thinking. Hopefully, Shag was thinking about the creed, about how to be himself under it. But maybe he was just thinking about the heresy Din had just committed in front of him, and how to punch Din in the throat and run off with all of Din's armor. Din cleared his throat and looked at Fennec, faintly embarrassed. Apparently, he said, still sheepish that he hadn't known what the darksaber meant when just about everyone else around him, including Boba, had. I'm the king of the Mandalorians. Fennec stared at Din for a long moment, and then she threw her head back and laughed. That was how Ashek found them another hour or so later. The suns had finally started to set, casting the canyons into shades of pink and purple, the night chill creeping in. The Tuskens and Shag had all ringed their banthas together, using the animals to block the worst of the chill, and Fennec's laughter and Jag's puzzled silence had given way to planning their counterattack. Fennec had not been particularly thrilled to hear that Quinlan Vos and the Jedi might be coming. Din had filled both Fennec and Shag in on what Quinlan Vos had found when he'd started to follow the leads he'd picked up under Gela's place. The kids that Vos and the other Jedi had freed. Gari. Fennec hadn't said anything about Gari or Geeta, about what it meant that Gorga had figured out how to twist the arms of the slaves on Tatooine even from a dozen systems away. Din tried not to be concerned about that. Not because I don't want their help, Fennec said when Din scowled at her. The Bacta she'd taken was starting to work on her, too, mending the bruises on her face, her swollen nose, the grotesque bend of her hand. How are they going to find us to help, Jaren? We can't count on them. We're in this on our own. Din scowled, but didn't argue. The Jedi were also several systems away, and Din hadn't exactly left a homing beacon back at the palace. Well, Fennec amended, catching the look on Din's face as a speeder began to rumble in the distance. Not entirely alone, the spotted Anubar back. Ashek's speeder whined over the sands, the sound growing louder and louder, echoing off the canyon walls as he approached. Fennec, when she'd heard the first distant rumble, had been pretty sure that it was Ashek approaching, but she still stood and went to check anyway, shouldering her rifle. When she returned, the speeder had cut out and Ashek was following her, Atima and Atin, two of Ashek's warriors, trailing behind him. The chieftain of the spotted Anuba greeted the Sunrock scouts first, then he looked at Din and laid his fist over his heart. Din's right arm was still in its sling. He planned to leave it there until he and the others made it to wherever the Hutmerks were keeping Boba and the rest of their people,
So Din placed his left hand over his heart instead, even though it was awkward, and inclined his head to Ashek.
You survived too, Ashek said, tracing the words in the air. Good.
Glad you're alive too, Din replied. It was hard to sign with one hand. He let his good hand fall and switched to spoken basic. He hoped that Ashek wouldn't be too offended.
Did you find Boba? Din asked.
Ashek didn't leave Din in any suspense.
Yes, he said. We found Boba.
He was still using the sign for king. Ashek looked at all of them, Din and Fennec and Jag and the Sun Rock, then continued. He lives for now. That was ominous. The hairs on the back of Din's neck stood up.
Where is he? Din asked.
Ashek signed something, but it didn't make sense. The sign required both of Ashek's hands. He brought them together, fingertips facing the sky, the heels of his hands pressed together, then curved his fingers to make a dome. Ashek rotated his wrists, opening and closing the dome like a bird's beak.
No, Din thought.
He knew what sign Ashek was making, but didn't understand why he'd be making it.
Not like a bird's beak.
Ashek, Din said slowly. The Sarlacc is dead. Boba killed it. Ashek was making the sign for the Great Devourer. For the beast that had lived for hundreds of years in the Pit of Carcoon, growing fat on the unlucky Shabuere Jabba threw to it while his court roared and cheered. A spectacle, Din thought. Cold horror lodged in the middle of his chest. And an execution.
Yes, said Ashek. The Great Devourer is dead, but there's more than one Devourer in the sands.
Jaren, said Fennec, her tone almost conversational. My Tuskra's not very good, but I could have sworn that you just told Ashek that the Sarlacc was dead. Why is Ashek asking about the Sarlacc?
Din swallowed. Ashek's gaze didn't waver.
He's not asking about the Sarlacc, Din said. He's telling me where Boba is.
Boba... Oh no, Fennec said, going pale underneath her bruises.
Din made himself take a breath.
Ashek's hands started moving again. Din didn't want to understand what they were saying, but he couldn't help it. He knew.
He's saying, Din said, translating for Jag too, that Gorga is going to finish what Jabba started.